Don't look at me, please. I don't know what I'm thinking. I don't know what everybody is. It's not ever going right.
I know. I know.
I'm so sad. I'm so fucked up. I'm so fucked up.
Hey, I'm really upset too. I'm sorry if this has anything to do with me, but I swear I really didn't do anything.
I wish you were nicer to me, though. That it was not very nice what you did to me.
I try, but it's really hard.
I don't know what to do. I don't know what to do. I don't have any place to go. I don't have anywhere to get better.
But you do. Like, really, Howard, you're my home. You could come to
I
me.
can't figure it out. I can't figure out what I'm supposed to do. Everything I do, it's not going right. Everything I do, it's not going right. And I don't know what to do. I really don't. And I don't want any more of this shit. I really don't know what to do. I can't figure this out. I gotta figure this out. I really do.
Hello, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. I'm your co-curator, Devin Decker, and joining me, my other curator on this journey into the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler, Sijin Sarwick. Sijin?
Hello, Devin, and tonight we are looking at a very important film, perhaps maybe the most adult fare that we've gone over in our work, but definitely a necessary watch, a necessary watch.
Honestly, Sijin, to say that it's all been leading up to this would be an understatement.
Would not be a lie.
No, it's really Uncut Gems is the film that we're discussing tonight. And oh my God, I can't believe we're here. I honestly can't believe that we're already here is
Yeah,
sort of the
actually,
thing.
it was a little hard to fall out of those characters because honestly, it felt like the two of them could have talked about this the entire night.
Right,
But
yeah.
yeah, man.
It's a, and I would love to talk as those two characters for the entire night on this movie.
We
But
talk a lot about Hubie Halloween being the thing that set this show off, and like definite, like yes, like that is
definitely Hubie
that's the lore,
Halloween.
but and definitely, the thing is that it wasn't just everybody saying, "Oh, Hubie Halloween established the universe. What do you guys think about that?" It was also the sub conversation to it, which this is not the first time we've talked about this, so we don't have to dwell, but the sub conversation of, does this mean Uncut Gems is in that universe? That really, it incensed me to the point where I felt we need to do a show about this to get the fucking story straight.
Yeah, to help people to understand that just because there's a shared cinematic universe featuring an actor and his work doesn't necessarily mean that every film that that actor has ever been a part of is in the universe.
Right, all of that work, right? I
Yeah.
mean, for numerous reasons, not least of which, this movie is not a, you know, it's not a Happy Madison. One of the rare ones we're going to watch that is not a Happy Madison film,
I mean, you say one of
and
the rare ones. We've hit a couple already. It's not the first non-Happy Madison film when you look at something
or
like
first
Funny
probably would have been like
People.
Funny People. That's fair.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah.
Although I do have the impression, and I'd have to go back and listen to the episode to see if we talked about this, but I do have the impression that some of Sandler's money was behind that movie, right? Like he was like for a movie like that, Sandler does not come on as just an actor, and perhaps maybe even in this, although that's not really something that's really talked about, right?
Right, but it's something that we are definitely going to talk about today, because that exact phrase that you use, that Adam doesn't just come on as an actor, is an interesting one as I'm watching this film, weighing it against the 18 entries that we have done prior to it. So the most important thing is this is the last technical episode of season 3 with our villains theme.
Right.
But if you went to the page today, hopefully this is the one you're listening to first because we gave you a double drop, right? It was a two-shot Friday. Is there a better term for that?
I don't mean the two-pointer. I mean
Yeah, it's
we're
true. It's a
doing a couple of
two-pointer.
basketball.
Basketball players don't really play double headers, though. If this was two baseball movies, double header would make sense.
That's why I didn't say double
Yeah, but that's a good point. I just wanted to say, like, where you kind of have your hands tied because of the nature of basketball. Oh, they can play every day, maybe every other day if they have to travel. But yes, this is the last one that is definitively in our theme of villains, and that's an important distinction.
Yes.
That being said, the other movie that we released today, The Hustle, which is also, if you didn't notice, there's an episode about the, or is it just Hustle? It's just Hustle. Yeah.
Yep.
Adam Sandler's latest release with Netflix, Hustle. Both of them are about basketball, but we haven't seen it yet while we're recording this episode. So we don't necessarily know what it's about.
So place your bets.
That's a good point, right? Do you want to take the parlay, the over-under, the lightning bet on how many points we go over?
I'm going to give it at least a 3-point spread that he dies at the end of that one, too.
Oof, that's a fair argument. I will actually take that action. I think he's going to survive. I think that he's going to find the truth and happiness in life. Honestly, I think it might be the other side of the coin of something like Uncut Gems, which is one of the reasons why we're covering it. But it is worth acknowledging here that this is the one that is the capper to season 3, and Hustle is a bonus episode. And I say that because we were sort of meticulous in choosing the films that represented our season 3 with the theme of villains. And while we have things like I Now Pronounce You Chuck and Larry,
yeah,
and Spanglish, ones where he's not necessarily a villain in the movie, but the reputation isn't the greatest.
True. Yeah. And then talking about movies in which he maybe is a a villain to his own career with like The Ridiculous Six. And,
right.
Like, and
or films where he is definitely taking a more antagonistic role in things like That's My Boy and Funny People.
Mm-hmm.
This film right here, Uncut Gems,
with like a Safdie's brothers amount of anticipation and buildup, we led to this as the true villain of our entire season.
Right, because this isn't just a film where Adam Sandler's character is pretty despicable. I don't think anybody, I certainly don't think Seijin would disagree with that. I think that, I have some takes on Howard Ratner, and I'm very excited to dive into them as this episode goes on, but Uncut Gems, origin story-wise, in terms of Hubie Halloween being our hero, Uncut Gems was the original villain. Until we saw Billy Madison and realized, well, it has to be Eric Gordon. Eric Gordon has to be the Loki, the one behind, I mean, not even the Loki, the Thanos, the one who is truly behind all of the machinations of evil that are pulling the atoms together. In the Avengers style film to be released in 32 years now, based on
the normal spread. Yeah. But I guess the big thing I will say is I'm not disagreeing at all with the idea that as a character, Howard has got some baggage that we need to unpack. He is not a good man. Right. But I really like this character for him. We'll get more into it, but I think that this is watching this movie, and to watch this movie is to watch this character, because I mean, like, he owns this film, is an experience. As far as I am concerned, like, up front, we'll say, like, deserves the praise that it got when it hit.
Oh, not only does it deserve the praise that it got, it earned every single person who said that it was robbed with Adam Sandler not getting a nod as best actor in this film.
Do you know, he apparently was on Howard Stern just before the Oscar noms had come out for that year. And there was buzz about whether or not he'd get one, and Stern, you know, obviously asked him, like, you know, how are you feeling about that? And something along the lines of, if I don't win, I am going to go out and make the worst movie I possibly can. Take that, you assholes, was essentially his attitude. And so, like, as we talked about Ridiculous Six, and the idea where it felt like he was kind of, or what movie was it that we were talking about? Was it That My Boy?
That's My Boy felt like a retaliatory strike.
Yeah, exactly. Apparently that is definitely something he is in his blood, so confirmation there.
Right. I don't think we've seen his worst movie ever, though, at that point, the movie that would answer that. Though, perhaps, he weirdly called his shot and releasing That's My Boy in 2012... because that's when fucking Uncut Gems is set. I don't know. This is one. But before we get any deeper into Uncut Gems and we talk about it, this is going to be a big one. This is, let me tell you, the first thing I wrote about 27 minutes into this in any sort of shared communique with Seijin was, oh no. And that's a pointed phrase, right? That can mean a lot. Oh no, can mean a lot.
Yes.
But before we unpack further into Uncut Gems, before we begin to cut the gem, as it were, just a quick reminder of why we're here, who we are, what the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe is about. So we've already kind of alluded to it. Hubie Halloween came out. The pop culture at large collectively lost its mind over the fact that there might be a shared cinematic universe of Adam Sandler films. Mm-hmm. As Seijin mentioned, in that first issue, if you're able to track one down, the conversation did turn to, well, how does Uncut Gems fit into that? Which really was the bigger impetus. I mean, certainly for Seijin. I mean, for me, it was always, well, yeah, Little Nicky already happened, and as I can prove now, all of the films that he released prior to Little Nicky get a little bit of a shout-out in Little Nicky. I didn't realize that The Wedding Singer was there until we did our Wedding Singer episode, and then I again revisited it. That, like, the peeper dies to This Is Ladies' Night, and it's John Lovitz.
Right.
That's The Wedding Singer right there. So, like, when the Providence Journal in 2000 called it a greatest hits, a clip show of Adam Sandler, they were not wrong.
They weren't far off.
And that clip show, greatest hits, full spectrum of Adam Sandler characters and comedy on display, that, to me, was the establishment of a cinematic universe of Adam Sandler. So to hear it brought up 20 years later that Hubie Halloween finally established it, I was a little perplexed. I was a little confused.
Yeah, I mean, people finally taking notice, right, of the thing. You know, it's the hipster vibe all over again, man. Like, I've been listening to this band for years. I mean, but at the end of the day, it's true. Like, we've got the facts and figures to prove it.
Yeah,
yeah, but the idea of a shared universe was something always there for us.
But rather than, well, actually, we decided that it would be better to educate what it means to have a shared cinematic universe.
Oh, because that sounds a lot less asshole-ish. And I get what you're trying to say.
Yeah, we didn't want to just call people idiots. We wanted to try to engage in the conversation, especially as people were coming up to us and saying, well, what do you think that means? You guys like Adam Sandler.
We wanted to open doors. That's what you do. Yeah. Once people took notice of this actual concept and people started talking about, like, revisiting the works of Adam Sandler, we wanted to give people a way to do that.
Yes. And so the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe was born. And the two guys, your two curators, the ones at the helm on the starship Sandlantis, that's a terrible name for this.
I was proud of you for pulling it out of your ass.
Yeah. It was better than the starship Sanderprize, right? Like, I had two to go with. I'm Sandlantis. Welcome to the starship Sandlantis. As we navigate the cinematic universe of Adam Sandler. The two guys at the helm, I'll do the introduction for my co-host here. I mean, you probably know if you've been listening to the show, but just in case it is your first, that boy over there at Seijin Sarawick, we have known each other for, God, 15 years, right? Seems to track, right? Mm-hmm. We've known each other a long time. We went through university together, and we've always sort of had a shared love of popular culture, and more so than just a shared love of popular culture, a shared love of the popular culture that is sort of the fungus of the genre, the stuff that might not get the most light shown upon it. And Adam Sandler, not that I would consider his stuff like things that are removed from the sunlight, but it's sort of like a seasonal, to continue the agricultural metaphor here. When Adam Sandler releases a film, everybody's talking about him, but then, you know, the bloom goes off the Sandler rose, and that's what happens, is people stop talking about it. But Seijin and I, based on our friendship and who Seijin is, we kind of never stopped talking about Adam Sandler. And Seijin and I together have been doing another podcast called The Say Report for 6 years now. We just wrapped our 280th episode of that, if you can believe it. Well, it's right on the desktop. It's staring me in the face. And we also just finished celebrating Brendan Fraser History Month, which is something that we do over on that show. And I'm very excited to jump into June with these two Adam Sandler ones with Seijin. And the last thing about the Sarah Port, that shows about everything, right? But with the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, we very much put ourselves into the rigid confines of just Adam Sandler and his offerings and how they relate to the world. And that's a little bit about who we are. I don't know if you want to say anything about me, Sijin.
What could I say that people couldn't have gleaned from that rant for the last 5 minutes?
Ouch.
But we found throughout our entire lives together that this was something that we enjoyed doing, not just with Adam Sandler, but with everything, which is why we started the show in the first place. But when so many people kind of came out of the woodwork, like asking us what was going on and if we were going to address the issue and things like that, we not only took up the charge, we ran with it. So,
yeah. I always like that. We not only took up the charge, but we ran with it. That's sort of the unofficial motto of this show. So, yeah, so that's where we're at. That's what the show is. And this season, like I said, we've been looking at more of the villainous films. Not necessarily he plays a villainous character, but maybe the film has sort of a bad reputation or he's more antagonistic in it. And naturally, if that's going to be the theme you're focusing on, Uncut Gems is going to be your centerpiece, your grand finale.
Yes, let us start from a place where we can agree. And that is that he is definitely antagonistic in this movie, right? As much as he may be the quote-unquote hero of this film, it is a true blue anti-hero, right? It's a wild ride. So we're getting kind of, as we talk about in some of these later works, we're kind of getting to a point where we're watching these movies as we're doing this show, right? Or as we're doing the Say Report, at least as we are at this point where we're kind of looking into things in this way. So it's wild to me because watching this movie, I've never not watched this movie without these like critical eyes on it. And in a way that like, I feel a lot of the older ones that we talked about, like I was able to at the time kind of just enjoy as they were. And only in retrospect, like really watch them in this way. So it's weird because my initial viewing of this film is all through the lens of comparing it to all of Sandler's earliest work. But I kind of feel like that's the way that everybody viewed this one. Like this, I think Punch Drunk Love is the only other one that I think really got viewed in the outer world, you know, not just amongst our friends, but like everybody in this same way of like, ooh, Sandler's doing something different. Because even the other movies that he's done that have been different, Funny People, I mean, I'm going to probably throw some love towards the Meyerowitz stories later and things like that. Like he has his other movies that are out of that realm, but they never seem to kind of, The Cobbler is another good one too. They never seem to kind of create the like fervor that these two movies in particular have, Punch Drunk Love and then eventually this one, right? And there's reason for that, you know, and we're going to get into it for this one especially today, but there is something really special in this movie. There's something going on in this movie that is really special. And you know, I'm not even saying I can even put my finger on it. I'm not going to like reveal the secret to you at some point, but like you feel it the entire time that you're watching this movie. Even the worst reviews for this film admit watching Sandler in this role was something else. But then they go on to say that they just don't like violence, or they don't understand why they had to say the F word so much. Like,
oh, you mean 509 times? Why'd you have to say fuck 509 times?
I cannot believe how many of the negative reviews, because there are some of this movie, that how many of the negative reviews are focused on such mundane nonsense. Like a lot of people saying they don't enjoy the soundtrack. I'll have words about that later because I adamantly disagree, but anyway, but like a lot of people saying stuff like that, but then so many people just being like the content, which is just freaking wild to me for like an R-rated like gangster film, like crying, like what did you, yes, yeah, man.
I mean, it's, first of all, the content is so funny to me, as the last movie we looked at in this show was Ridiculous Six, which has that moment where Harvey Keitel just gets fucking decapitated. And it is not only one of the funniest set pieces in the movie, the movie is adamantly aware of that and thus references it like 12 times.
Yes,
like going as far as to reference what just happened, like no less than 30 seconds after it happened.
Oh, man.
And it is.
Yeah, no, there's the amount of people that's through their, you know, clutch their pearls at this movie is pretty wild. But I think what that speaks to is more this touched more people than those kinds of, you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, this movie got out there and affected more people. So in a weird way, like, looking at a negative review, you can obviously say this many people didn't like it, or you can say this many people watched it. Like, the idea that it reached an audience so large that it garnered these kinds of numbers is pretty wild. Yeah, because I don't know, this movie to me is true movie magic. Having, you know, really, in all honesty, watched it for this show. Like, that was always the way in which I viewed this film and still view this film. It is something that I did for this. And I am now going to carry this movie with me much longer than half, more than half of the movies that we've gone back to, you know?
Interesting. For me, this was one of those films I was super excited to see. I would say it's sort of the definite wean on me being obsessed with seeing everything that could or would be nominated for an Oscar. Because there was a time in my life where I wanted to make sure that I was in the know for everything. And that all broke in, I'll say, 2018. I think that was the last actual Oscar episode we recorded for the Say Report.
Probably, yeah.
And it broke when something else came up that I was interested in more the night of the Oscars. And then not watching the Oscars and still, like, being able to go on and communicate with society and
still live afterwards. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Like, it was one of those things where, like, the curse is broken. Huzzah. But this was still one of those movies where, I mean, first of all, it's Adam Sandler. And, you know, I talk a lot about where I kind of, like, drift away from Adam Sandler and then I come back to him. The last real Adam Sandler movie that I had been, like, hopelessly devoted to was Pixels, which, ironically enough, is the last theatrical release that he had. Live action theatrical release, because yeah. Hotel Transylvania 3 had occurred, and I believe Hotel Transylvania 2, though don't quote me on that. Those two had happened, but like live action ones that I definitely would be like, oh, it's Adam Sandler, and I'm interested because of the topic of the film. Like, yeah. This is one of those movies where I'm like, yeah, it's Adam Sandler, but like that trailer is friggin' pulse pounding, action packed. I want to see this fucking movie. And then it comes down to, it released on Christmas of 2019. That was when it had its wide release. And generally, we would go to the movies on Christmas, but we decided that this particular film might not be the best for Christmas. This is a group of people who went to go see The Hateful Eight on Christmas, I guess 2 years before. But we're like, no, for Uncut Gems, let's wait. And what we waited for was my birthday, which is 10 days later. And we went to a small theater in Mystic, Connecticut to go see the film. They've since changed hands. I'm not sure even what the name of it is anymore. And we went to go see the earliest possible showing of Uncut Gems. So there was only there were three of us, maybe eight people maximum in the theater to see Uncut Gems that Saturday morning. Mm-hmm. And it was such an intense experience that, like, afterwards, I just kind of had to sit quietly on a bench outside and just, like, recollect myself. Like, yeah. The film hit so hard. And one of the reasons why, when the whole Hubie Halloween conversation came up, was, like, that film hit so hard. And in a way that, like, I can't remember another film that Adam Sandler has ever been a part of has had an effect on me. Right. It'd be like mixing gold in with dirt and expecting people to be like, yeah, they're all the same.
No, this movie's a punch in the gut. Like, yeah. No bones about it. Like going into this film, be prepared. If you have not yet watched it, first of all, go watch it. Secondly, it is, you gotta almost like be ready for it. Cause if not, like it gets you. And maybe it's better to not be, I don't know.
I mean, going in unprepared for what this film was going to be was an exceptional experience. It's one of those like cinematic experiences that I would tell like future generations of Deckers about.
Yeah, I mean the killer is, I guess, at this point is I don't know how you go into this movie and not kind of know that something's coming because of the way it's discussed.
Yeah.
So I think kind of that boat has sailed. So with that in mind, like, just, you know, prepare yourself for what you're getting into, right. Because man, it is a ride. Like it is one of those movies that never stops. And in fact, I think that's like an important kind of part of the genre that it falls into is that it just never lets up. And so to that, like everything is working towards building up that anticipation for something to the catharsis in the final moments of this film, like the acting, the way in which like the script is written and also just like the way it's filmed and the music and everything is working together to just build tension. And like, I can say that as much as I want, and you're never going to truly understand how much until you actually watch this movie.
Until you're embroiled in it. And I don't usually this is where we talk about our first impressions with the film. I'm sharing a second impression with this one, because this has been a movie I've been like reluctant to go back to because of that, like that feeling that I had that first time that I saw it, even to the fact that I was invited to an event to discuss this film right before everything shut down for the pandemic in 2020. And I ended up like at the last minute, like passing because I didn't feel ready to be a part of that.
Yeah.
Just to be honest, like with myself where I'm like, I'd have to watch the film again. And I don't know if mentally I'm prepared for that. So it has been, let's see, it's June, right? So it has been 2 years and 4 months since I saw this movie where I sit down to watch it again for the show. And that second time through, I enjoyed it so much more than the first time, where like I was off kilter and everything kind of took me by surprise and all of that build. And I could really appreciate it as a film. Yeah. And like, because you talk about
that is interesting.
Yeah.
Because, yeah. But,
that it's all build and that it doesn't really slow down. But then like knowing what's going to happen, there are these beautiful moments of not silence, but like almost stillness where it's still alive. It's still kinetic, but it's so subtle what is happening and how it plays with everything that's going to come afterwards.
Well, it's almost like it's a faux release. Like
yeah.
You think, oh, things are calm for a moment, and then suddenly you realize it's not. Whether it's because of an event in the movie or the music or you just come to terms with what's actually happening. Because like there's all of these wonderful moments where you finally think the guy's going to get a freaking second to breathe. You are going to get a second to breathe, and the movie tricks you. It pulls the rug out from under you.
Yeah.
Like this movie constantly plays that trick on you too. So there are definitely moments where it starts to slow down, but it's only in service of the Safdie brothers then ramping it up like even harder.
Exactly. But that's the thing, is that once you know that like the rug is about to be pulled out from under me as a viewer,
yeah,
you use that time to breathe.
Yeah.
And some of the just beauty that they put into these small moments of calm, of serenity, are beautiful moments that like I just didn't notice the first time because I was just on full drip 100% caffeine with the tension that this film was delivering. And yeah, it was wonderful. Even so far as that, the third time I watched this movie with like a notebook in my hand and to like really dissect it and get ready for the episode taping, it was. And that's the best type of movie to me. A movie that can be rewatched and it not necessarily be a new experience, but a different experience that builds each time you see it. This film, I was impressed that this film was able to do it, because I was a little bit nervous that knowing who Kaiser Soze was, it wouldn't have the same punch.
Yeah, and you know, all credit where credit's due. It's not like this was the first time the Safdie brothers had kind of blown everybody's mind with this exact kind of movie. You know, they have a style to them that was seen even just a few years earlier in Good Times with Robert Pattinson. And Good Times with Robert Pattinson might be, I keep saying that because I say Good Times and a lot of people don't know that there's like a movie called that that he was in. And
it's a good time, isn't it? Good Times is John Amos.
Yeah,
good time is Robert Pattinson.
Yeah, but there's it is a lot of the same concepts. It is a day in New York. It is just over like the top of anxiety building. He is trying to get his brother out of prison. It is all kind of fitting into the same world. You could have seen those two characters run into each other in this movie, and I would have believed it like instantly. And so there's something about that kind of movie that these guys are just really good at making. So like, if you were familiar with their work, it may not have the same kind of surprise feel that it did as somebody that's viewing it as an Adam Sandler fan coming to it. And I think that's also a lot of why it kind of gets the remarks and the popularity and some of the disdain that it gets, is because there is a lot of people that are coming to this movie specifically for the face of Sandler, and that this is what they get in light of that. And a lot of people, I just don't think we're ready for that.
I would call it the Spanglish effect.
Yeah. I don't want to like act like this was such a surprise film to anybody that was paying attention. It wasn't, but it sure was to me, because like I was not a huge like follower of the Safdie brothers and things like that, but you better believe I now will be.
Even as somebody who was like paying attention to it, I was really only paying attention to the trailer and the Adam Sandler of it all. Like,
right.
This is one of those situations, like Spanglish. The reason why I bring up Spanglish is notoriously the reason why that film is so universally loathed, outside of the fact that James L. Brooks is a white man writing a Latin woman's story in 2004. I think I just stroked out for a second there. It is the fact that people saw the trailer for Spanglish and assumed it was going to be your sort of standard Adam Sandler fare.
Yeah.
And even though the trailer for Uncut Gems clearly does not do that same, like, that same sort of lie of marketing that Spanglish did, certainly not to the same extent that Spanglish did, he still comes off as, like, a jolly, funny, charismatic character in that trailer. So, that's why I want to see it. I want to see Adam Sandler doing this. And then you hear all the rumblings that, like, he can win an Oscar for this role. You're like, oh, is there something more beneath the surface? Or is it just the fact that, like, because he's in an independent film with the Safdie brothers, that, like, finally the right people have taken the time to notice him and his nuance?
I want to keep talking about this, but I don't want to get too far without undercutting our usual fare.
Right. Well, I guess so. I was gonna ask you, do you have any facts and figures on this one? How did this film do?
Yeah. So this, as you stated, this came out for wide release around Christmas. I think actually literally on the 24th. Yeah, but it had actually been out for a couple of weeks before that, because it came out on December 13th, I believe.
Yeah, that's when it was limited. IMDb says that its wide release was December 25th. But also, the way that works now, it means the Thursday before and whatever way that they can get people to go see movies, they're going to do that.
The only reason I'm saying the 24th is because if you look at the box office numbers, it goes from getting like $600, $2,000, $3,000 to suddenly getting like $1 million in a weekend. So it's like, okay, definitely came out to wide release on that day. So it's a late December release, which puts it square in the middle of award season. This is a friggin' wild year. This is one of those years where I look at the movies that came out, and I could have sworn some of them came out 20 years ago, and I could have sworn some of them came out yesterday. But nope, they all came out in 2018, which is like crazy. Christmas of 2018.
No, 2019. This is a 2019 film.
2019. Sorry,
it's okay.
But it's that same year that we have Knives Out, that we have Queen and Slim is out. Ford versus Ferrari is this year. Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, the Tom Hanks Mr. Rogers one, which I again could have sworn was sometime in the last like year and a half, but no, apparently it was about 3 years ago at this point. But the idea that like this is coming out in that kind of crowd is wild, because it was a hell of a year for movies. I mean, the other thing is, this is the year that Parasite has been out, but by the time this comes out, Parasite's already been out for a few months, but still, like, that is the movie that year. It's also the same year as Jojo Rabbit. So, like, there's a lot of really dark movies, I think, is kind of the big thing, I guess I will say. The ways in which these movies play with this, even Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. No, not well. I guess even that one, if you think about
there's
it,
there's some darkness in that one. Yeah.
It's told through the lens of a guy that is like basically ready to kill himself until he meets Mr. Rogers. But there's a lot. There's just so much going on that we're exploring in terms of just darkness, and I think it's because we're kind of getting to a boiling point. right? Like things are just coming to a head. I mean, we're in the middle of some of the worst years as far as the politics in this country go, at least in our lifetime. And like, there's so much going on in people in culture and the ways in which people are talking to one another or not talking, but rather committing terrible acts of violence against one another. And then all of a sudden, you know, what was it like? Not 3 months, 4 months later, is like the whole thing comes to a head when we all get locked in our houses. God basically put us all in a timeout for 3 years. So like, this movie is coming out like right in that, like right in the middle of all of that. And you feel it throughout this entire movie, even though the movie is supposed to take place in 2010. And they wrote it back then. It's not like they wrote it like a period piece, wrote it as a 10 years ago piece. They wrote it in 2009. So actually they were writing it for the slight future. And then, but you know, movies, the
well, way it's 2012. Made, so. It starts in 2010. That's when the gem is found, but then it fast forwards to 2012. And the only reason that I mention that is because the 2012 Celtics play such a big role in the story.
Yeah, although the season that they're talking about them being in, I mean, the Celtics are just, it's really easy to pick a year where the Celtics were doing really good. Let's put it that way.
But it was the year after they had won the ship. They won the championship in 2011, and I will remember that forever because the trainer at a temporary job I had talked my ear off about her son being like, oh, I'm really into hockey and basketball right now. And her response was, you know that they don't always win the championship, right? I don't want you to be a fair weather fan. Like, understand that there's going to be some pain. And then a year later in 2012, we see that pain when the Celtics have what we see in this movie, right? Yeah. With that season in 2012. And then they go on to have an amazing 7-game series against the Miami Heat, only to lose it in game 7 by like such a small margin.
Yeah.
That like people were devastated. Like living in the New England area, people were devastated by that season. Cause we thought after 2011, where like every team won a championship almost, thought like we're unstoppable, we're undefeatable. And that was sort of the first domino to fall. It was insane.
Yeah, yeah. So definitely the movie evolved from its time that it was written in 2009 and things like that. So again, as what happens with movie production, right? Especially if you're kind of doing your own thing, which the Safdie brothers, even after the success of this, I think are going to continue to just do their own thing.
Well, they were offered a big name superhero movie and they said, yeah, no thanks. We want to do our type of movies. Where Uncut Gems continues from, is the place where we could have done a big name superhero film on the success of Good Time, but we decided against it. And also, they were going to take that 2009 script and place it in present day. But the reason why it moved back is they were able to get The Weeknd to be in the movie. I wish I knew his real name, not just his stage name. Is it Abel Tayvac or Tayez? It's something like that.
I don't know how to say it either. I'm sorry. I wish I knew how to say it properly as well. Yeah. But
when they got the Weeknd on board, they decided to shift their focus to a time where he would be playing at clubs where Howard could just like go to the show, where it wouldn't be like big, you know, stadium concerts. And then once they found that time, they tried to find the most likely NBA player who could cross paths with it. So even though this film was written in 2009, their original plan is, but we can modernize it for anything because of what this story is about. It could happen really anytime. But then they end up doing it as a period piece because of the people they are able to get to be in the film and wanting to make it feel authentic.
Yeah, 2012 is kind of the kickoff year for The Weeknd doing his own thing. Before that, he had kind of been doing a lot of backing track work and things like that. And then 2015, just a few years later, is when he has his huge breakout hit with leading the charge on the soundtrack for 50 Shades of Grey, right? Mm-hmm. Isn't that? Yeah. So that's 2015, I think. It places it squarely around The Weeknd's career.
Oh,
right?
Yeah. Right. And then because, it's squarely around The Weeknd's career, who's somebody who had this type of series where they had a killer game, a kind of crap game, and then a killer game again, who would also be around New York? And they're like, I guess Kevin Garnett, right?
Right, yeah.
So, like, this movie is also, an example of just like the right things happening to happen.
Yeah,
the way they needed it to.
Again, like, movie magic. The best movies are always talked about in this way, where like it almost didn't get made, right? Like, isn't that the whole like Godfather line right now with everything going on with the TV? Like it's this idea that there was always that chance that everything was going to fall apart, and because it didn't, they were able to make this piece of cinematic history that is going to be recognized for years to come. So to that point, right? Like, it comes out and it is an instant hit. Like critics wise, we're talking like just A pluses across the board. There's a ton of stuff about how people are like, you know, talking about Sandler in his dramatic roles and the ways in which like really you should be viewing two different Sandlers and all this stuff. Right. What happens when it goes to a wider audience is when you really kind of start to see the cool down as far as like numbers go. As I pointed out, you look deeper into some of those criticisms of this film, though, you know, it ends up being kind of a 50-50 split for a lot of people. But if you look into some of the negative criticisms of it, just like when you're buying a product on Amazon, you should always actually read the reviews, not just go off of like the hard number, because sometimes you realize that some people are just like out of their friggin' minds, because the number of people that talk about this movie and not liking it because A, it's not the funny Sandler they like, right? Or B, like they went in and they got such terrible foul language or the content in terms of the violence and there's just so much going on. A lot of people that feel like there's too much happening all at once is a big thing, which like that is going on, and it definitely makes you uncomfortable, and it definitely like grinds you in a terrible way, but like they are doing that on purpose, right? But there is also something that really gets really interesting as far as the conversation goes, because of so many people talking about how I think the actual quote that I saw is that if you only ever saw this and Punch Drunk Love, you'd be forgiven for thinking Adam Sandler was one of the greatest actors of our generation. And what's really wild about that statement to me is it openly acknowledges the idea that you can do everything in the world for anybody, but the second you kick a puppy, you're known for the rest of your life as the puppy kicker, right? Right. It's that idea that like no matter how many good movies Adam Sandler ever decides to put his efforts into and actually pop out, at the end of the day, people are just always going to be looking at him as the clown that like, oh, well, he tripped and fell into his success in this one. And that sucks, right? Like, how many good movies does he have to make up for the quote unquote bad movies that other people have seen and that they don't like of his, right? And that is something that, like, you know, we are all kind of guilty of, right? Like, we put people into slots, we categorize, we're humans, right? But as when it comes to films, right, if we hear a certain director's involved or certain actors involved, if it's a certain style, there's people out there that are like, I won't watch anything animated, things like that. Like, the second you start kind of putting up those barriers, you are cutting yourself off from potentially something, you know, mind-blowing, something that will change that point of view. That being said, if you don't have time to dedicate yourself to opening your doors to things like this, you know, like, that is also a choice, right? But that recognition from a film critic that, man, I really love it when Adam Sandler does A, B, and C, but because he's done D, E, and F, I just can't ever like him again. And it's just like, that sucks that like there's no way to get past that, especially because what we're talking about is, oh, he made Bedtime Stories and I hated that movie, so I'm not going to give anything else the time of day. It's not like he did something terrible like, oh, he turns out he's, you know, like racist or something like that. Like, no, it's not something that is like inherently about Adam Sandler they don't like. It's just that they've seen him do work that they didn't like, so all of his work now must be in question.
Yeah. It just taints really everything.
Fun. Yeah.
Yeah. One bad Sloppy Joe will ruin the bunch. to just pick a random food, right? All right, cool. I mean, I think the
Are
big...
Are you dipping the Sloppy Joe in Sloppy Joe-ness?
Yeah, it's Sloppy Joe. Sorry, I needed some Adam Sandler comedy in this film, because oof. But I guess, do you know how much money it made? Because I know that like the big fact that you see about this movie is Adam Sandler generally gets paid $20 million to be in a movie, and Uncut Gems cost $19 million to make.
Yeah, so this movie actually sets a little bit of a record for A24, who produced it. It ends up being the best money-making movie that A24 produces at the time, only surpassed this year by Everything Everywhere All at Once.
Yep.
So its record was finally broken within the last couple of months. It is a $3 million film that ends up garnering $50 million. So like it is a cheaply made movie, and then after that ends up going on to make more than its money worth, and weirdly it's only a domestic number that I can get a hold of. I don't know if it didn't technically release wide, because it was a because it was also technically a Netflix release, although it was in theater. It kind of gets wrapped up in that weirdness.
Yeah, it's a Netflix movie in every country but America.
Right.
Which is
so
something.
In America, it actually did get a wide release, so it gets some domestic box office numbers. So yeah, it ends up bringing in $50 million in the end. And so A24 gets to kind of prop that up, and then this movie becomes, you know, something of a gem to them, as it were. I literally didn't even mean to say that. It does well. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. Like it's a successful film in all regards.
Excellent. And I agree with that. And it's nice to have it confirmed by the numbers, not just be one of those ones that like, oh, the critics like it, but audiences are not going out just because the critics say it's worthwhile.
I don't know why I said $3 million. I pulled that number out of my ass. I must have been looking at that number. It was a $19 million film, but it did end up making $50 million in the end. So
yeah, which is impressive when you consider the fact that internationally that doesn't even enter into the equation.
Yeah.
And another thing that's impressive about this film is that it's all shot on film. It's on 35mm, this entire film. So the fact that they're able to make a film for $19 million, shooting it on film, it also says something about, I guess, the efficiency of the type of filmmakers the Safdie brothers are. I mean, that's how I choose to look at it, because, you know, film is not cheap.
No, but if you look at some of the ways in which they use, you know, sets and things like this, and I mean, they're just on the streets in New York. I mean, Mohegan Sun, they're only ever in like one room of that hotel. Of that casino, and yeah. It's the bookie room.
They're in the sport book,
yeah.
Yeah, spent a lot of times in that sport book.
Yeah, man, Mohegan Sun showed up, and then it actually being Mohegan Sun, kind of.
Dude, not only it actually being Mohegan Sun, the manager who counts the money is the manager of the booking room. Like that's like, oh, it's Chad. What's up, Chad?
Yeah, it was wild. Yeah. But yeah, it makes $30 million. There you go. That's where your three came from. Yeah. It makes $30 million over its budget. So, again, successful film all around. And again, A24 like props that up for years as like a record for them.
Yeah. And why shouldn't they? All right, cool. So, I mean, we've been talking for a while. Do you think it's time for the synopsis? Is it time for that little detour?
For the first time ever, I think your synopsis is probably going to be a little bit chiller than the movie itself.
I will take that bet to continue to be an asshole and just ride that into the ground. Despite living the American dream, Howard Ratner wants more out of life and has turned to sports gambling to stoke the embers of his passion. Unfortunately, he's not very good and already $100,000 in the hole to his brother-in-law, Arno Meridian. Luckily, Howard is acquainted with Damani, who happens to be friendly with none other than Kevin Garnett of the Boston Celtics. Damani has convinced KG to come to Howard's showroom, but the only thing that interests Kevin is a rare Ethiopian black opal that Howard has already promised to Adley's auction house. Seeing how it seems to energize Kevin, he reluctantly agrees to let him borrow the gem, accepting his 2008 championship ring as collateral with the explicit instructions that it be returned before 9 a.m. the next morning. No sooner has Damani, KG, and his entourage left the shop before Howard is out the door to pawn the ring and place a $40,000 six-way parlay bet on that night's game, convinced that that Kevin's perceived magical power of the opal will lead him to play the game of his life. Despite the odds, Howard wins his bet and takes off for the city from his Long Island home to celebrate with his associate at the store, Julia, with whom he's engaged in an affair. While things seem to be on the upswing regarding his gambling, Howard soon learns it was a mistake to trust Kevin with the opal, as he is now refusing to return it, jeopardizing his deal with Adley's. To make matters worse, Arno's goons were tailing Howard when he placed his bet and stopped it, costing them $600,000 in winnings. That same night, after being stripped and locked in the trunk of his car, Howard receives a call from Damani telling him he has the gem. They meet at the performance by the weekend, but Damani doesn't have the stone. Distraught, Howard finds Julia in the bathroom with the weekend, leading them to break up. The next day, Kevin returns to the shop with the opal and an offer to purchase it for $175,000. Howard declines due to his commitment to the auction, but tells Kevin that he can bid on it come Monday. Unfortunately, Adley's has reappraised the Opal from the original $1 million to $175,000, needing to make at least $250,000 to cover his costs. Howard enlists his father-in-law Gooey to help raise the price. A fine solution if Gooey hadn't ended up being the one with the winning bid. Out of options, Howard agrees to sell the stone to Kevin Garnett for $165,000, which he has Julia place $155,000 on a three-way parlay bet that will be worth $1,229,000 should he win. Again, with the odds stacked against him, he wins his bet, but this time Arno's goon Phil is sick of his shit and shoots him in the head, thus ending the tragic tale of Howard Ratner. But at least he died the one thing he always wanted to be, a winner.
All right. Yeah. So a couple of things that we should probably point out in that. First of all, the movie leads us to believe that Howard's in deep shit the entire time because of his terrible gambling addiction and that he's very bad at gambling and loses all the time. Except both times we watch him play huge, unreasonable bets in this movie, it works out for him.
Dude, huge, like, unreasonable bets that could be lost before the first second of fucking gameplay.
Yeah, yeah, because one of the things on the bets is the tip off, right?
Yep.
If the Celtics didn't win
both of those tip offs, Howard would have lost both of his bets.
Yeah. So in a weird way, I feel like Howard's a very good gambler. But he has magic on his side, which we will talk about. True. But the larger thing is that this movie, by all accounts, is obviously a parable, right? And if you actually look into it, the Safdie brothers actually view it as a Jewish parable, and they based it on a family member, I think their dad, who was an actual jeweler in New York, and like his relationships and the banter and stuff that you see going on in this movie, and the people that you see in this movie are all people that they were very familiar with, like every aspect of them,
especially the guys that Howard pawns the ring to.
Yes, yeah,
and then
yes.
Like those are guys that they actually knew. And it was more inspired by their father worked for a very Howard Ratner-esque character. That's what they say. So I want to choose to believe that their father isn't the person that Howard is based on,
but the fact that he worked in that industry, they had access to people like Howard and all of these people that you see. I mean, and the markets, the places, because that's the other big thing that's crazy about this movie for me is it. If you really actually take a step back and look at what one of the things that's viewed in this film, it's actually the weird back markets that go on in this industry of like the diamond exchange in New York, where like he walks into a building and has to go through a lot of security to get there. But then he ends up on a floor where there's like five different jewelers' offices around him, and they're all trading stuff back and forth with each other and that sort of stuff. And I'm sure that that's all what happens, right? Like, I mean, especially in that industry, because so much of that is based more on when all of your money is based on jewels and gold and bullshit. Jewels and gold and bullshit end up becoming very good things to trade back and forth because you can cut out the middleman of paper cash, right? Mm-hmm. So there's just a lot of that sort of stuff going on. But the bigger thing about it being this like this parable-esque story, like watching him just spiral further and further and further down the drain, and it all being just a hell of his own making. I say hell, but they just don't believe in hell, actually. But that idea being that he constantly finds himself suffering at his own expense. Like he is the one that is causing all of his shit to kind of fall apart. So that's the other big thing that makes him very kind of villainous to himself in this movie, is like there is not a moment where something happens where you don't like want to slap him for what he has just done, because you know and he knows that he has put himself in yet another super precarious position. But it is all with the idea that he's chasing that dragon, right? Like he's trying to place that final bet that can finally get him out of the game. And it is that dramatic, you know, build to that moment when he finally does it, and you finally think for one hot second maybe this is going to be the one that gets him out of all of this. And then boom, he gets killed, right? And that is the story. And I mean, it is so much a parable that the last final moments of this movie is over his dead body lying on the floor of his own shop, is then Kevin Garnett like basically giving you the moral of the film.
Yeah.
About how like you have to work for it. You can't just buy yourself into success. You have to work for success. And, like all of the stuff that he's saying, it almost feels like it's like them the Safdie brothers like wagging a finger at you.
And it also feels so crafted, that their narrative to that speech, because that's what Kevin Garnett said after the after the game, right? Like, that's
right.
real recording of him. But they almost craft the narrative so that final interaction between Howard and Kevin Garnett is Howard essentially saying, this is how I win. This is how I play the game so that I can win. Is I do it on the sweat and the toil and the pain and the misery of other people, because that's the only way that I can feel the way that you feel when you win a game.
Yeah.
And then Kevin Garnett to be like, I mean, you're not going to win that way. Like, yeah, you got to put the work in. You have to do it.
And the reason that he is in any way redeemable, if you want to call him that, or at least somebody that I personally could, like, watch this movie again, because, you know, a lot of the other criticism that comes at it is that he's an irredeemable figure and it's no fun watching him be that way. And I totally get that. Like, watching people that are just the worst. Like, I have a hard time watching reality TV because reality TV specifically frames people to just be at their worst, and I don't need that in my life. The reason that this movie works for me is how many times you see Howard recognize this problem within himself, but things around him are moving in a way that he finds himself unable to change. And he tries maybe in a couple of moments, and you want to give him that, but he doesn't succeed for some reason, right? Including up until the final moment when you think this might finally be it, and then that choice is instantly taken away from him. And it is so – that final moment is so well crafted because it's also like there's no dramatic build. It comes almost out of nowhere. Like, it makes sense. They earn it. It totally makes sense what happens. But the fact of the matter is like he turns around. He's like, hey, guys, let's all celebrate. He opens the door for them, and then just boom, that guy just lays him out.
Well, it's before that. It's the fact that Arno, played by we're fans of him, Eric Bogosian.
Yeah,
I felt like, I can't believe we had such a deep conversation about Eric Bogosian, completely forgetting that he plays Arno in this film.
Yeah.
Arno almost like forgives him when he actually wins.
Yeah.
Like, he understands that, like, oh, you locked us in this door because if you hadn't done that, we would have fucked you over the way we fucked you over the last time you got your big victory and your big win.
Yeah, Arno's a really interesting character too, because like as a character, like his whole thing about wanting to not look like an idiot to the family, and he takes it really personally when he gets called that by Howard, calls him that earlier in the film.
Yeah.
Like, there's a lot of really there's a real sadness to that character.
He's the strangest thing is that most of his motivation is jealousy. He is so jealous of Howard. And this, like, weird acceptance that he has from their shared in-laws.
Right.
That, of course, he's going to give him shit out in the real world where he actually has the power. It's the way for him to feel powerful. Because there's no way that Judd Hirsch... I just fucking love Judd Hirsch. I want to sing his name from the goddamn rooftops. How much I love Judd Hirsch. That Gooey would ever go to the fucking mattresses... To borrow from The Godfather, for Arno, because Arno is not Jewish, because Arno is an Armenian, and Gooey only views him as an intruder, an invader into his family because of his marriage to his daughter.
Well, and it's another cautionary tale because of the ways in which Judd Hirsch doesn't accept this person into the family. It generates a lot of the problems that we then see in Howard. Not all of them, and I'm not taking any blame away from Howard for his actions, but like, this movie doesn't happen if Arno does not also have some built-up shit, and both of them are dealing with crap that they have been kind of feeling because of the way that the generation before them has put upon them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's really, there's so many moving pieces in this film, and I could understand how someone might be overwhelmed by that.
Yeah.
But the central focus for me, especially after watching it the three times, the reasons why I cry for Howard, and I do, there are moments where, like, even the scene that we did at the beginning when I was, like, preparing to do it, I had tears in my eyes as either character, because it is this, like, final emotional release from both of them, because they're so guarded, both Howard and Julia, until that moment where, like, let's just drop the fucking bullshit and be honest about how we feel towards one another and the world. The biggest truth about Howard is that he does not care or love himself. He hates himself. Howard mm-hmm. Ratner fucking hates himself. Yeah. And because of that hatred of himself, because he is unable to see his own value in the world, he fails to see all of these moments in the world where people care about him. He is so fucking blinded to people who legitimately give a shit about him, yeah. who would gladly talk to him and try to help him through these fucking issues.
His girlfriend and his ex-wife are both fall into that category for me. And I think the one moment for me that really highlights this, that really kind of really hit a little hard, is in that moment after he has been killed, and we know he's dead, but obviously nobody else in the movie does. They start kind of doing like a shot to on like what everybody else is up to at the moment. And they go to the house where his ex-wife and his son are and are watching the game and celebrating the win and all this stuff, and his son is just like ecstatic, like, my dad knows that guy that, like, my dad is friends with him,
my dad had his ring.
Like, he is so proud of his father for that in that moment. You know, say what you will about it, like the relationships in this movie, like, there is something about the idea that at their core they do clearly all love Howard and they want to take care of him, but he pushes everybody away in this movie.
The one for me, the one that breaks me, because it's clear, like, even the friggin', what is that, barbecue chicken, when she's cooking the thing, that little smile she gives him when she shows him the meal, like, it's not completely gone. There's still some love for him from Dina in that moment, and it's, I love it. I love that moment. But the moment that fucking breaks me is when he goes to Steve to pawn his 73 Knicks ring, which is his prized possession, right, to get back Kevin Garnett's 2008 ring, and clearly Steve sees that Howard is frazzled and at the end of his fucking wits and rope, and he's like, Bubby, is everything okay? And, like, that's a guy who is in this same world, right? This same mm-hmm. diamond exchange. Sure, he's out in the open in that big open air market. He's not in one of these back rooms where you got to be buzzed in. That's for the high clientele who don't want to be seen buying fucking bedazzled Furbies or the like. Mm-hmm. But that moment where he fucking just drops his whole character as the hard ass pawnbroker guy to be like, seriously, Howard, if there's a fucking problem, tell me, and I will try to help you. And Howard, like, just brushes it off because he's so focused on the next step of what he yep. has to do. And it rips my heart out, because, like, that guy, and we've only ever seen that guy in the one scene where he's like, we both know that the value of this is strictly memorabilia. I'm not giving you $80,000 for this.
Yeah. Oh, man.
It's just like, there's so much put into that guy who, like, by all accounts also is not an actor. He's a guy who really just is in the industry that the Safdies know.
Yeah. No, they pull phenomenal work out of so many people in this movie that you would not peg for acting, right?
Mike, I mean,
one of the big wins for this one is Kevin Garnett, right? Like, yeah. we can't keep talking about him in this movie and not praise the fact that, like, he does a phenomenal job in this movie. And then like gets credit, like, a lot of people are really surprised by that. But the guy that I cannot believe I have not seen more about, is this was his film premiere, is the dude that plays the asshole there. What is his name?
Keith William Richards. Phil.
Keith William Richards, who plays Phil, who ends up being he's Arno's kind of like
heavy
big muscle
goon, yeah.
But he's just the guy that's just like, you know, we should not be taking this shit from this guy. And Arno just keeps like trying to calm him down. And eventually it all comes to a head and he just can't control him anymore. Right. Yeah. And that is the big build, but he is,
I mean, you want
to
talk
scary.
Jewish parables, it's the Gollum. But
he is terrifying, like, in this movie. And he, there are moments where he's not saying a word. I mean, when you first see him, it's kind of out of the corner of the camera's eye, right? When Howard first gets into the shop and he knows that somebody's there waiting for him, and you've been informed that there are people who are waiting for him. So you catch him and the other guy, right? Phil and I think Nico is the other guy's name. I think
that's his name.
And so you do see them and you do clock them, but it's him. Like, the presence of him in that room instantly makes you really uncomfortable, and you're like, oh no, like, that guy's bad news. And then, like, that everything from there on, every time that dude shows up on screen, it scares the crap out of you.
My favorite memory of that character is,
and again, his first movie. Sorry.
Yeah, just like, no. That's what it's tied to, is my mother going, what else do I know him from? And I'm like, nothing. This is his first movie. You might know him from, like, the Mean Streets of Providence, right? You're always telling me fucking stories about your times in Providence, and you know, you're well-known in the Russian community, Ma. I don't freaking know. Maybe you know him from a deal that went south, but you don't know him from another movie. And she's like, that can't be true. And then I think it was CBS Sunday Morning, or one of the morning shows that my parents, like, watch religiously, where they did a whole feature on, like, this unknown guy who is really the main presence in this film, starring Adam Sandler, after 22 years of, you know, being on film and in our minds and in our hearts.
Yeah.
Like, and just stealing the show. I mean, it's one of those moments where I see him and I'm like, this guy's not an actor. And it's the scar on his neck. Like, this guy has seen some shit.
Oh, yeah.
And that is the reason why he is playing this role.
Yeah, he's been asked about that, and he has a straight-up quote where he was like, I grew up in Brooklyn. You answer your own question, is essentially, like, the paraphrase of the answer. Like, he's like, I'm not going to answer that. Like, but I grew up in a certain lifestyle, so that gives you your answer, right? And that's all he'll say. Yeah, man, I don't know, like, where or what he will ever get the opportunity again, but I would pay to watch him.
I would watch him do
some more.
Oh, so much. He's fantastic. He's phenomenal. Okay, so before we go any further to the discussion of Uncut Gems, I think it's time for that old reliable, that thing that you get every time you come to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe podcast, and that's something new, something old, something borrowed, something blue. Because Adam Sandler's done a lot of wedding movies. Someone asked me, why you do that? And I'm like, he's done a lot of wedding movies. It's like a clever nod to that. And also, it's fun, and it forces us to find four things each movie. And, you know, it's a good way to move it along. And people like segments. Someone once told me, your podcast needs segments. And I'm like, okay.
Yeah, well, this is how the sausage is made, people.
Yeah.
Do you want to start us off, or would you like me to take the first swing?
Whatever gets me to not have to go first on... No, I'm going to go first, and then I'm going to go first on borrowed. That's going to be how this goes.
Okay.
Okay? So my new... And fuck me for this, and I apologize, is Billy Joel. Billy Joel is going to be my new in this movie.
Okay.
Because weirdly, around like this time where Adam Sandler is making movies and stuff, Billy Joel becomes an odd presence in these films that and TV shows that Happy Madison is a big part of. And this is the first time, and I can't believe it's the first time, that we're covering one of the movies that features a Billy Joel song. And the big one that I think of, and, you know, I don't even know if it's going to be considered part of it. This is far, far into the universe before we're even going to truly deeply talk about it, is Kevin Can Wait, where they have the whole episode where going to a Billy Joel concert at Madison Square Garden is the plot. And then Kevin winds up on stage with Billy Joel. But to talk about actual Adam Sandler movies, the entire soundtrack of The Week Of.
Oh, yeah.
Is Billy Joel. So for this to be the first movie where we come across that Adam Sandler, Billy Joel cross-pollination, it really stuck out to me. And it also stuck out to me because it's the stranger of, like, all the Billy Joel songs to be featured in an Adam Sandler movie that we're covering for the ASCU. For it to be the stranger, it's oddly poignant for Uncut Gems.
Yeah, I think that kind of opens the door really well for mine. My new, and you know, this is a little on the nose, but needs to be said, is this is the first true thriller from Sandler that we've seen, right? Like, this is the first thriller Sandler. We have not dove into some of his more dramatic works, really, and the ones that we have not been this, right? Like, this is like the intense, like I don't know what's going to happen next, and I don't know if he's going to make it movie, and spoiler alert, as we've already said, right?
Like, there's the end of my synopsis. I hope you saw the movie before you watched the show. This is his 1-hour photo, is all I want to say.
Okay, yeah, yeah. But, you know, we also know that Williams also had, like, insomnia and stuff, too, right? Like, so right. It wasn't the only thing he had done.
Were the same year. Like, we always act like, why are those two movies invariably linked in our mind? One came out the beginning of summer, one came out the end of summer. But when you say thriller Adam Sandler, I think of the long, like, line of comedic actors doing that thriller movie.
Eventually doing that thriller to kind of break it.
Yeah.
Well, what's weird is, like, Sandler has always kind of tried to break out of comedy, and it's just never quite hit for him in meaningful ways. I mean, all the way back to, like, Bulletproof, you know, and which is still a comedy, but, like, not a Sandler-esque comedy at all, right? It's more like a...
it's a buddy cop sort of deal.
Well, right, like, right. I was going to say Lethal Weapon style. Yeah. Like, yeah, it's funny, but this is really more about, like, some pretty dramatic action that's going on. But, yeah, so this is the first time that we here have had the pleasure of dipping into thriller Sandler, so like it should be noted.
Yeah, especially when we've covered things like Murder Mystery,
right? Well, like, and even Hubie Halloween is like kind of a turn this on its head. This coming out and then getting Hubie, and then people talking about like Sandler being able to scare up some like fun thrills in Hubie. Like, well, yeah, like the dude can definitely build tension with his acting. He knows what he's doing when it comes to that, and this movie proves that in droves. Yeah.
I love it. I love that a lot. What do you got for old, Sijin?
So actually, I don't think we've come across anything too much in this film that would be considered old. But as far as Sandler goes, this is the second time in as many years that he gets to hang out with Judd Hirsch. Judd Hirsch is also in the Meyerowitz stories, which, while not being a Sandler Netflix film, is a Netflix film. So I got to remember to pull that one out of contention as like one of the Sandler produced ones. It actually just happens to be just one of the ones he's in. It's a Noah Baumbach film with him, Ben Stiller, Judd Hirsch, but Dustin Hoffman, who plays the patriarch of the family in that one, and he doesn't have many scenes with Judd Hirsch in that one, but he does get more than some of the people in it because Hirsch plays a smaller role. He plays Dustin Hoffman's character Harold. He plays his best friend from childhood or whatever. So they go to an art opening of his, and Sandler gets to have a couple of moments with him. So it was one of the things that hit me as I was watching this. Is I was like, oh, we're with Judd Hirsch again. That's really cool. But other than that, like this is a very shallow well when it comes to some of the older Sandler stuff. You know, this isn't him getting his buddies to come around.
I really wish you hadn't pointed that out, but we'll get there when we get to the discussion. Oh god, I really wish you hadn't pointed that out, Sijin. I just need to be honest with you. Which brings me to my old, and this is maybe my favorite part about this film. What I'm about to cite is the old. There are so many moments in this movie where Adam Sandler drifts into old character voices.
Mm-hmm.
The specific moment that stuck out to me where I'm like, this is something I want to watch out for, is when he is calling Arno after Phil has taken the watch and his money the first time that they rough him up in his shop, and he's calling Arno. He's like, what the fuck, you send these guys to my shop and they rough me up and they do it, and his voice is so Eleanor or Jill from 8 Crazy Nights and Jack and Jill respectively, but it is so interesting to me how that voice that is meant like purely for comedy, those voices were developed to be comedic, right? How it's such a thin line from it being like the funniest fucking voice you heard to it being like this meaningful sort of emotional filled, this guy is like on the brink moment. Yeah. And it's like, it's such a thin line between tragedy and comedy.
Well, so this is a really, yeah. So this is going to snowball for a second here, folks. So just buckle in. But essentially, like, what you're getting to is at the end of the day, as much as we talk about Sandler and doing these funny character voices and it being a really great part of his comedy career, the thing is like, the reason why it works for Sandler and doesn't work for everybody, the reason why the Jerky Boys are not still around and Sandler still is, right, is because his comes from an earnest place of honesty. The characters he's creating, as goofy as they may be, he can cite the people he is like talking about or making fun of or emulating, shall we say, when he does those voices. They are coming because they were real people around him, right? To that, like, Howard is this figure that you can definitely lay a lot of crap on Howard as like, as far as representation goes, and it is super problematic. And actually, a lot of people have. There's a lot of talk about how this movie does have these elements, shall we say, of anti-Semitism. I'm not really in a position to judge one way or the other. I see what's on screen as a bunch of people that have grew up with people like this representing them on screen. I could be educated to feel differently at someday, but right now that is the way that I feel about it. Right. And to that, like, I think that's what you're talking about, is that he puts on this voice in those moments and throughout this whole movie, he puts on this character that you kind of feel like, man, this could easily fit in with some of his other more comedic characters, but it's just not because of the set dressing. And I think what that speaks to is the honesty of it, is like, of the character that he's playing, the reason why they could all talk to each other and they would all seem like they're familiar to you is because they're all real. Like, and especially to Sandler, when he dives into those characters, he is those characters. He knows who those people are. He has entire stories about them. It's why characters show up more than once throughout his career. It's why constantly he feels like he's going back into the same well, and a lot of people give him shit about that, but it's because he's just going to a place that's familiar to him. Yeah. Right. And whether that works for you or not is up for debate, but that is where that all comes from. Right.
I mean, and what I said is, it's this argument that came around this film that Adam Sandler is actually this good actor. Like, he has layers, like, he should be in talks to win a Best Actor Oscar, all of that stuff. It really stems from, I mean, there's a moment where he does the Donnie Berger voice talking about his son, where, hey, that's my boy. And it's just like, oh my God, that was Donnie Berger. But coming out of Howard Ratner, it's almost fucking tragic. I mean, Donnie Berger's kind of a tragic character too, but fair. Like, it's just one of those moments where I'm just like, oh, that hit my ear very strange, in the fact that you're not wrong. Howard Ratner, he is a charismatic character. He understands how to make connections to people, because at his heart, he's a salesman, right? So he knows the voices to put on and the tone to put on. And these moments where he is like sad, the breakup with Julia after the whole weekend thing, the voices that he put on, I'm just like, oh, I know that one. Like, it's like a little bit of Tollbooth Willie and a little bit of this. And it's just like, oh my God, the fact that like all of these character voices that he has cultivated over the years, like, can also fit in this heavy dramatic setting and then like not break it really is impressive to me.
Yeah. No, it is really kind of evidence that the talent has always been there. It's about how he has chosen to use it. And some people don't agree with the way that he has chosen to use it, and that's their loss. No, I mean, that's what you get to choose to do. You get to decide the entertainment and the media that you take into your body and what you do with it once it's there. But like, he has, I think the bigger thing for me is he has always been this way. He has always had this talent. He has always had this ability. He has always had this in him. It is almost effortless to him, or at least he makes it look that way, to do this kind of work. And so for people to get so like surprised by it, and it's got to be the reason that he then says, like, if I don't win an Oscar, I'm just going to go make another shit movie, because what's the point? Like, I can do this work. I have proven it time and again, but people want to keep acting like it's such a huge surprise when I do. I'm not, it's very failed, like criticism, right? Like, yeah. Like, people say it as if it's praise, but all you're really doing is shitting all over the other 20 years of his work that he's done.
Right. And it's also a perfect encapsulation of the fact that, oh, I really like Adam Sandler in these two, but the fact that he was Happy Gilmore, I can't do it. And it's like, yeah, but the fact that he was Happy Gilmore and then was also willing to take on the challenge of being Howard Ratner, yeah. You got to give him some respect, not just because he was like willing to branch out from a heavy comedic role, like, say, Bobby Boucher, but also the fact that he did it in a way that you, Mr. Movie Critic, were like, wow, he did a really good job.
Yeah, I mean, you know, this is not a term unfamiliar to the Say Report, but it's probably the first time we're going to say it here. But we're talking about ghosting, right? The idea that we see an actor on screen and we cannot think of them as anything else but this other thing. So seeing them in this new way, like, it changes the way that we view both characters now, both the one in front of us now and anything that came before it and anything that'll come later, right? But this idea that we kind of ghost this idea of who Sandler is with us every time we watch one of his movies, and that's kind of what this whole endeavor has been about, is about this idea that people have this vision of who Sandler is, and then every movie gets held up against it and it becomes either a hit or a miss depending on what people think of and what that and all this. And so if we, there's no way to not do that as a viewer. I mean, if somebody out there has the ability to do that, I would love to talk to this X-Men for a second and figure out how they just like did just ignore everything that's come before in their memory. But like, it's acknowledging that, it's knowing that I'm bringing that baggage to anything, to a movie, to a song, to a TV show, to a painting, like anything that I am bringing to art. And I say like, okay, I am viewing this art right now at this time in my life, and I have this context that's making me feel this way about it, and I don't like it, is like totally like a defendable, legitimate position to come from. And that is kind of something that we've lost in a lot of criticism, because so many people out there are now criticizing things. It's such high volume so often, and we're not always given the space to do it. Look at Twitter, right? 140 characters, or what is it, 240 characters now?
Yeah,
whatever nonsense
now. Yeah,
but like that amount of space doesn't really give you the time to fill everybody in on like the context in which you viewed the movie, so you kind of just spurt out how you feel about it and you move on. And that is such a detrimental part. Like it's such an important part to understanding how we feel about anything, that to not have that as part of the conversation, we have lost the conversation. And it sucks, because like we can't do anything nowadays without somebody having a 2-second opinion on it, and that 2-second opinion now becomes the epitome of the opinion. You know, I think of like those moments when like Mark Hamill gets in trouble for talking about not loving parts of the new Star Wars scripts, and people automatically take that as like, yeah, he's on our side, like he hates the new trilogy too, and then he has to come out and be like, no, I actually very much like the new trilogy. I just don't necessarily know if I would have ever imagined it would have gone in this direction. And the question that I was asked at the time was like, did you see yourself being alone or not? No, like he was just once he contextualized his feelings about it, suddenly everybody was just like, oh, he's just a Disney sympathizer. Like, okay. Like,
well, I mean, also, if you got to consider that there was that whole expanded universe where like Luke Skywalker got a happily ever after, wife and kids and all this. So then to actually come back to the universe to play that character, it's like you've actually been a hermit for generations.
Exactly, right? Like there's this expectation in this context for what we thought that character was going to be, and for it to not be that sucked. So the question is, if we didn't have that context, would this be a thing?
Yeah.
Same goes for this Adam Sandler movie, right? If you didn't have the context of watching all of these other movies, and this was the only movie of his you saw, you would go, damn, he's a fun actor. Like, he's a great actor.
What the hell's this guy? Has he done anything else?
And then imagine seeing Little Nicky after this. What would your thoughts be? I don't know. I honestly couldn't tell you.
Yeah, there's going to be a generation where that could potentially be what happens, and I'm interested to have that discussion.
The only killer there is that this is the R-rated, like hard R-rated movie that I was about to say comedy, and that's the other thing, is the amount of people that want to talk about this as a comedy on both sides of the fence. People that didn't like it and it wasn't funny, or people that love it and they think it's the funniest movie he's ever made, and I'm just like, I can't talk to either of you.
I mean, there's some dark comedy in this. That's undeniable, but
there is definitely comedic moments. And even some of the terrible shit that happens, like it's one of those laugh or you'll cry things. You know, I remember going to see Burn After Reading, and me and Pat Boz, and we were the only two in the theater that laughed afterwards. And like the lights came up and we looked at each other and we were like, people realized this was supposed to be funny, right? And then we were like, was it supposed to be funny? And we watched it again. And we were like, no, it was definitely supposed to be funny. But it's that idea that like sometimes that stuff hits, sometimes that stuff doesn't. And like, and if you're not the kind of person that's into it, I get it. So criticizing this movie because saying like, look, they go to some dark places and you're expected to laugh and I don't love that is one thing. Talking about this movie as if you first of all thought it was going to be a dick and fart like joke filled movie and it wasn't, that's on you for expecting something like that. But if you watch this movie and you think this is the funniest movie Adam Sandler's ever made, I don't know if I want to spend much more time with you. Like, that scares me about your like personality.
I'm a little worried about the things you find funny. Scott, I gotta be honest with you.
Yeah.
All right, so into Borrowed, which admittedly I didn't really have anything until the last minute. It was very difficult to find something, so I'm going with the easiest thing. Howard Ratner's house is Freddie Mercury's house from Bohemian Rhapsody.
That is a wild pull. That is awesome.
It was one of those things where she's like, I know this house. Is it Tony Soprano's house? No, it's the Bohemian Rhapsody house where Freddie Mercury's like dying and then he goes to do Live Aid.
Whose house do they steal in Bill and Ted?
They're bringing the third one. Dave Grohl's.
It's Dave Grohl's house. That's right. Okay. Oh, man.
But it's so weird to say, like, they borrowed a setting location, because then you could just be like, oh, it takes place in New York. New York's kind of a character. And, like, it's baseline, but it is one of those things where I think it was a conscious choice on the director's to give him a semi-iconic house to have you understand as a viewer that, like, Howard Ratner is successful. It's not like he's trying and failing in his business. It is just the fact that, like, he doesn't feel any excitement in his life. So that is why he has turned to betting.
Yeah. No, he's had a lot of things come easy for him. So he makes problems for himself. Yeah. That is this character's biggest flaw is yes, gambling, but that gambling is really just a symptom of this part of himself where he's had such an easy life that he just doesn't, he goes looking for trouble because he just needs to make his life difficult. And like, and you know, he gets called out on that. Like his wife, just, or his ex-wife, I guess it's still,
they're
wife
still wife. They don't, yeah. I mean, she's his ex-wife at the end cause he's dead, but they keep pushing off the divorce. Which is another big indicator of the fact that, like, and she's fully aware of the relationship. If they were Italian, I would call Julia his guma. Because they're Jewish, I, like, toyed with, like, is Juma acceptable? And I'm like, let's not say that.
The answer is no, Devin.
Yeah, I know. And I wanted to make sure that I was aware of that. And thanks for co-signing that. Yeah, no, it was just one of those things. But Guma is really what Julia felt like in terms of, like, when he's like, I got to stop by the apartment. And she's like, oh, daddy has business at the apartment. And I'm just like, she knows. She know all along. And in some ways, I think she understands that, like, for this guy to function in the world, he feels like that's necessary to complete him.
He has to take stupid risks that put himself on the line with everybody and anybody, including her. And she hates and loves that about him. And she makes that clear throughout the movie. Yeah.
And also to just tie back to what we said early on with, like, something like Chuck and Larry. I mean, just because there is a societally recognized healthy marriage, that doesn't mean that every marriage has to fit into that groove.
Yes. Yeah.
Like, like the fact that, like, when his bad choices affect their kids, and that seems to be her line, when the fact that, like, where the fuck were you for our daughter's play? Why haven't you gone to put our youngest son to bed? He's been waiting for 25 minutes. Like, those are the moments where, like, it's a bridge too far for her. Where, like, you're being a shitty father to our children. But, like, she's willing to put up with his shit because she knows that, like, that's just part of the package to have him in her life.
And she's in a position to make that decision, right? Yeah. Like what little authority she has, that is her flexing it, right? Is she's choosing to still allow him in her life, but the kids don't have that choice, and she makes that clear to him.
Yeah.
She's like, you don't get to treat them this way because they do not have the privilege that I do to want to be here with you.
I don't know. It's an interesting thing. It's great to have another Adam Sandler quote unquote villain film where that nuance of what is a happy marriage is explored.
Yeah. So for me, this movie, Sandler is not necessarily at the creative helm every step of the way with this movie, right? Like, we've talked about the brothers and all that sort of stuff and how this was definitely their movie. Did we talk about the fact that they actually offered it to Sandler in 2009, 2010?
No, we haven't brought up that, yeah.
He didn't even get the chance to, like, read the script. His, like, agent was immediately just like, no, he's not doing this shit. Like, and so it never got into his hands. So they've even wanted Sandler in this project for as long as it's existed. But the idea that that this is a genre film through and through, because it is a kinetic crime drama. Like, and so the movie, and what's really wild about that is that's a little bit more of a recent style, only just because of, like, filming techniques. Like, so you look at movies like Collateral and, like, Training Day, even the Ed Norton one there, about how he's going to prison in the next 24 hours. So he needs to, like, say goodbye to everybody. And he ends up kind of involved in shit. The 25th Hour, that's the name of that one. So you get these, like, really kinetic, like, nonstop, like, you're kind of giving a ticking clock, and you hear the ticking clock the whole time. But this goes back to movies like, I mean, hell, like Chinatown, or The French Connection, right? Where you see these movies that are just like they just kick off and they just never stop. And it's always people doing bad things that are just doing worse things to try and get themselves out of the bad things they've done and all this sort of stuff. Like, and this movie is so influenced by that style of film. And I think that's more the Safdie brothers in general are just influenced by that style of film. Right. And so Sandler coming on board is a happy accident in the fact that he loves old cinema and loves this kind of stuff, but it's why he slips so nicely, I think, into this role with them and giving them the ability to do what they want with this movie is because he loves cinema so much and movies so much. And these guys clearly love making movies. Like, it is definitely a movie watcher's movie.
Yes, I don't disagree. And that's actually interesting to look at, like, the type of genre and the influences being what is borrowed, as opposed to in the past, we've looked at, like, whole hog moments that are just sort of lifted and inserted into the film out of love and reference. The fact to be like, no, we want to make a movie like this. And Adam Sandler's like, I am on board for that.
Yeah.
And also, even though he's not in like a creative helm, the fact that I think because you have somebody like Adam Sandler in the film, the set itself is more of an open dialogue and discussion about what to happen. I'm thinking primarily about the fact that Julia got Howard's name tattooed on her ass, and that being a thing that, like, Julia Fox suggested that way for her to show.
It's really interesting how much more scripted his comedies actually are, because if you look at things like Funny People, Meyerowitz Stories, which is a couple years before this, and then this, like, these three bigger dramatic movies that he had done that pretty famously all are pretty improvised, like, not necessarily like they didn't have a script in hand, but like you're saying, somebody on set goes, oh, what if we go this way with it, and then you have a writer off screen that's just like furiously putting it together. In this case, it's the writer directors that are furiously then putting the scene together, and then they hand you the lines to say, right? And that's a lot more with like what's going on in these movies. So it's just really interesting that his more dramatic work turns out is more often than not his more improvised work.
Because it's really straight. The moment for me is when Kevin Garnett is first in the shop and, you know, Chekhov's fucking breaking case of jewelry. I don't even know what you would call it. Where, like, he just throws in, KG, please don't lean on that. Please don't lean on it. And I honestly feel like that is spur of the moment kind of peppered in. Like, that feels like such an alive moment. And one of the things that supports that is the fact that the Safdies rigged up the jewelry cases to be able to break them, and they didn't tell any of the actors that, so that their reaction to it breaking would be genuine. So the fact that, like, that right there is the director basically asking you to do an improv in the middle of this scripted moment.
Yeah.
And I don't think that you're willing to do that as a director unless you know the people who are on set. If you don't have someone like Adam Sandler there who's able to steer that whole fucking scene once the case breaks under Kevin Garnett, I don't think you're willing to take that risk.
Yeah, no, you need to have your Leo in the room who ends up doing a 10-minute scene with a slice in his hand in Django, right?
Yeah.
Like, you need that kind of trust in your workers. And, you know, and I hate those kinds of stories of like directors like pulling shit on actors just to get like real results and things like that. But, you know, it happened. So, like, I'm not going to like not talk about it. But yeah, like you get moments like that for sure throughout this. And they really do lean on Sandler and his improv chops to just kind of carry a lot of the scenes in this movie. And like, he slips so well into this character, and he slips so well into the dialogue style, because the other thing that's really unique about this film is that I'm going to attribute it to Richard Linklater, but he's not the only one that did this, and he was not the first person.
Robert Altman is who I would
put on. Yeah. But like the ways in which that we're talking like real people. So sometimes people talk over each other. Sometimes you end up with these lines that are lost, or maybe one person in the room hears it and somebody else doesn't. Like, you just end up with a lot of that kind of speak going on. And the fact that he is just like, Sandler is just throughout this whole movie doing that, and he's doing it kind of on the fly, is just phenomenal work.
I mean, I just to go back to your whole, like, I hate when directors do that, where they like legitimately put their people in danger. I do believe that everybody in the room knew that one of those cases was going to break at some point. Like, yeah, I feel like that's the thing. But the fact of the matter, and that's why so many times of like, KG, please don't lean on that. And like, because I feel like that is a scripted moment the fact, like, please don't lean on that. Please don't lean on that. And, like, feel free to throw it in whenever he's doing it, to the point that, like, we know that it's going to happen, right? You don't show a gun unless that gun's going to go off.
Right.
So, like, I think it's not like there's going to be broken glass. Good fucking luck, guys. Signed your waivers.
Yeah, I know.
But I think it was more the fact that they didn't know when or where.
Yeah, I think more of, like, the way that, like, Kubrick treated Shelley Duvall on the set of The Shining like that, and, like, just terrible, like, mind games just to get the actor in the moment.
The way that Alfred Hitchcock literally acted on every one of his sets.
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah, I agree that that's, like, that's toxic fucking Hollywood, and I hate when I hear stories about director doing it, but in this film, I have, like, that moment is just so good, and it's so, choreographed. It's so well choreographed, I'm like, they had to have known that one of them was going to break. It's just that situation of, like, but when is it going to happen?
Well, especially if you're improvising lines.
Yeah.
You know at some point it's going to break. You just don't know when it's going to happen because they're going to do it off of a vocal cue. You just don't know which one, right? It definitely makes for a beautiful moment in the film that, as you said, definitely foreshadows a lot of what goes on. And I mean, honestly, there's a ton of foreshadowing in this movie. Like the entire opening moment for Howard specifically. I mean, we didn't even talk about the actual opening moment as much as we said
in 2010 at the Wello Mines.
Right, where we're given the entire concept of like people must suffer for others to be rich, you know, to succeed, I guess is the right way of saying that. But the idea that, like, nobody ever wins in that equation is essentially the idea, right? Like, and we see that throughout the rest of this movie. But the opening moment for Howard alone is this moment of him unconscious and lying on a table. Like we see him come into this movie, like lying there and in almost a dead state. And he leaves this movie in that same way. Right. The other thing is in that moment, it's never confirmed, but we're pretty much told he's dying. Right.
So it's actually confirmed that he's not dying. Okay. It's one of those weird things. So it's interesting because it fuels sort of his devil may care attitude throughout a lot of the movie, is this fact that, like, it's heavily implied that he is coming up upon the time that his father died, which is why he is getting a colonoscopy to see if he has colon cancer, because it seems like that's what his father passed away from. So he gets a colonoscopy and he is told there is a little bit of area of concern. We're going to run a biopsy on it and I'll get back to you. Right. So that's like the whole setup. And then that scene, where Damani is there and he's like, I'm taking back all my shit from you. Where the hell are my watches? And he dumps that, like, blood red drink into the fish tank. And it has the most genuine moment of Roman being like, you're going to kill the fish. Like, and again, that feels like a moment too, because of just how genuine that response from a guy who's literally a jeweler, like, delivers in that moment.
Yeah.
It's just like, Damani, you just need to go friggin' crazy.
Yeah.
At this. The phone call that Howard is handling in that, and again, to talk about the Robert Altman overspeak sort of influence from the film, is Dr. Blauman from the first scene calling and telling Howard that he's got a clean bill of health.
Well, once
that
again,
it was nothing.
It's once again, it's another bet that he loses, right? Yeah. Or he wins. I mean, he's in this position where he has this overlying fear of death, right? And the thing is again, pulling back and looking at this as a Jewish parable, is this idea of, like, that is a constant in the Jewish culture, is, like, at the end of the day, you're not going to beat death. Of all of the bets you could place is not going to save you from this, right? And that is such a motivating factor for him throughout this movie. But yeah, and we're introduced to that instantly when we meet him, and it carries through all the way to the end. At the end of this movie, he finds out that he's healthy, he's finally gotten some stuff back on track with the people in his life that he loves, and then on top of that, he wins all of his money, and then it's all instantly just taken away by something out of his control.
I mean, you say out of his control, but, you know, we'll save it for the discussion. What's your blue boy? Make me sad.
I mean, you can't deny the racism on display in this movie, but specifically, like, the anti-Semitism that is coming across in a lot of the ways the characters are portrayed. I can't really speak to it from a position of like, knowledge, so I'm not going to sit here and wag my finger at this movie for what it's doing. But it is definitely portraying people in certain walks of life in terrible ways. Like, and so to that point, it does catch some heat for that, and there are some questions brought up by that. But there's also a lot to be said about the idea that, like, in this fact that it is created by people that are of that faith, and the fact that it is meant to be this kind of story that is kind of a cautionary tale. In that, like, you have to acknowledge that, and sprinkled all throughout Judaism and in its folkloric history is this idea of stories of people doing terrible stuff, and we learn from those people. And so, like, it fits right in if you know enough about the culture. But if you're not so familiar with the culture, or if you're so invested in the culture that you know, you feel like this is not fair that other people get to kind of see this and be a part of this with you because you didn't give people permission to be there, like, it can come across as unkind in a lot of moments in this movie. And so that is, and what's wild to me is, that's really the biggest thing I can levy about this against this film is, like, some of its use of language is really not cool, and, like, the ways in which people are portrayed is a little, but it is all in service of what is going on and acknowledged and, like, and part of it, versus some of the stuff that we've seen in some of his other movies where, like, there's just been some horrendous shit that has happened in Adam Sandler movies that I cannot look past, right? Portrayals of people that are maybe trans or at least cross-dressers, like portrayals of people that are of different races and different classes and things like that, that have just been really horrendous. This movie actually manages to not hit me in those ways. Maybe because of the ways context, maybe because of the context of the film, but man, I couldn't believe that of all of the movies that I really didn't come away with like a solid, like, this was really offensive and really didn't need to be done. A lot of what happens in this movie is so in service of character, so in service of story, so in service of the moment, that, like, it's kind of hard to deny. You know, it's like watching American History X. Like, yep, it's a movie full of racists, so some racist shit happens.
Yeah, and also I think it speaks to one of the reasons why you can see it serving the purpose and sort of being part of the story as opposed to just sort of, oh, this is the comedy of the time, this is who everybody's punching at, something right. Like the issues that we saw in say Chuck and Larry or the Ridiculous Six, to talk of two other villains from the season. There's also the fact that this is his most recent film, right? Yeah. So that's going to reflect the way that Hollywood is acting and interacting at the time, right?
Yeah.
That we understand that, like, these are words that are being said because these are the people who are seeing, or it was the culture at the time. I mean, specifically 2012 New York, they dropped the N-word a lot in this movie, but yeah. Like everybody was dropping the N-word in New York. It was just part of the lexicon.
Yeah, it was that idea of we're taking it back, right? Even people that didn't have the right to be taking it were somehow part of that movement.
Well, like, the amount of times that I was called that, and I'm just like, oh, okay. Like, so that's just what you're going to refer to me? And then coming back to Rhode Island after that time, like, living in New York with people in that scene and just the way that the language worked there, and having to retrain myself to, like, that's not how I can talk in Rhode Island. Like, that's just not acceptable here. And then we come to find out, yeah, it really wasn't acceptable there either, Dev. It was just, like, this weird moment that you got caught up in culturally.
Yeah, no, I mean, speaking of, like, cultural moments, right? Like, we're kind of in the moment of a big cultural shift as far as comedy and stuff goes right now for a lot of reasons.
Yeah.
But there was, I don't know if you saw this, but the other day, Patton Oswalt got interviewed for being a bit of a shock comic about kind of his attitudes on things. And he, you know, whether you agree with it or not, what he talked about was the idea that, like, you know, we kind of set up a blueprint throughout the aughts and the 2010s for, like, people to be allowed to do and say whatever they wanted in really hurtful ways. And we have to answer for that now. We have to examine that, you know, and some people did not like that he said this, although I will point out that what he basically said, and he even implicated himself in it, was not necessarily that it shouldn't happen, but that the ways in which it happened led to these moments that we are currently in. And we really do need to, like, examine that and figure out what we can do different going forward. And, like, that is true, right? And that's exactly what you're talking about, is, like, acknowledging in the moment that what was going on then was this thing, and we need to learn from that so that we can get better, be better, right? So this is not to say that this is why they include all of it. This is not, I mean, it is, though, right? Like, because at the end of the day, it is showing what this world is like and why this world is not one you really want to find yourself in. And part of that colors all of that. Does that give people carte blanche to do and say like a bunch of shitty stuff and film it and like put it out there? No. And it should always be examined and questioned when it comes out. So anybody out there that's looking at this movie and saying, look, there's some stuff that happens in this movie that is racist, that is anti-Semitic, that is, keep doing the work. Like, keep doing that. Keep calling this movie out. Call out all movies for this sort of stuff. The problem becomes when people out there on either side want to somehow take that as like an end all be all of this thing should no longer exist. That is where it becomes dangerous for us. And we've had this conversation a million times on especially on the Say Report, right? The idea that like to remove something from history because it is offensive is not the move, guys. To acknowledge that a thing was offensive in its place in history is definitely something that should be done. But to completely remove it, ignore it, and deny its existence is just not the way to go about it. So what does this movie do? Like, this movie captures a moment, and whether or not we love that moment is up to us.
I mean, specifically, you think about someone like The Weeknd and his whole discussion about how he approached playing this character, which is himself, but at a younger age, right, where he's like, I was a fucking diva back then. I was needy and I was whiny because I thought that's how I had to act. And like very much that influenced that whole scene where I'm like, where's my black light? I need my black light. And it's just like. Like
compared
that's even...
to, I think about that in comparison to watching the Kanye West documentary that went up on Netflix, and yeah, like in the ways in which he acted then and the way he's acting now, and clearly not doing the same self reflection that The Weeknd is doing. Yeah. So,
but it's just great because I like watch it and I'm just like, first of all, I had forgotten The Weeknd was even in this movie, which is really saying something considering, didn't he perform at the Super Bowl? Like a few months later, which is just crazy when you think about that. But it is really interesting because so often, like, we don't get that. We don't have somebody playing themselves at an earlier point in their life and getting to acknowledge, oh yeah, no, I was a piece of shit back then. Like, I did not know how to act, and that is where I decided to try to put myself in this moment. And it's really strange because The Weeknd to me is the hyper sanitized, I'm actually a virgin version from American Dad. So to see him like the way that he is like pushing up on Julia and she is denying him, but then he puts her hand on his cock, like, oh my God. Like, yep. It really, it's also really interesting in sort of a similar way to something like The Wedding Singer having this period piece, but only like 8 years removed from from the time.
Right, like a period piece that was clearly not intended to be a period piece, but like kind of falls into it by the nature of the time where they end up setting it. It's fucking bug wild to me that at the end of the day this is going to become a period piece, right?
Yeah,
like it kind of in the same way that all movies eventually will, right?
Right,
this movie just kind of owns it up front as opposed to letting it happen 20 years from
and
now.
That's not something I like when I thought of this movie, I didn't think of it as taking place in 2012. And we'll get to that, too. I want to finish Blue, and then we'll move on to... We've had a lot of really, discussion there.
Yeah, the only thing that really made me place it in 2012 was his leather jacket the whole time. The big leather jacket as opposed to, like, a nice tight-fitting one. But go ahead.
He looks so good in that jacket. Which brings me to my Blue, because I still don't think I understand how you're approaching it. It's the suit that he wears on auction day.
Nice.
It is that navy blue suit that he wears on auction day. And really, it reminds me of so much of the other blue that we see throughout Adam Sandler's filmography, where they put him in blue to kind of show that he is a blue-collar person, right? Yeah. That he's one of the guys. And Howard Ratner is not one of the guys, right?
Well, it puts him. They put him in blue to make him stand out from the usually upper class crowd around him, right? And so to show that he is the blue collar guy, and they do that same thing here.
Exactly.
Like he ends up sticking out like a sore thumb in that place.
And I feel like, and in a lot of ways, it's a conscious choice by Howard to do that, to go there in a blue suit so that he sticks out, so that he just looks like this proprietor who's like just sort of happy to have this thing and to have it accepted into this like esteemed auction. So like maybe the bidders will want to spend more to try to help him out. Like he it feels like such a conscious choice.
As a character,
as a human, he peacocks.
Right.
Like, yeah, he even has a peacock eye on the wall of his shop. But it's one of those. But it's one of those moments where, like, even in this moment where he is trying to hide his plumage, it is he can't fight the person that he is.
Exactly.
Yeah. It is, and I had to make sure. I'm like, that's a navy blue suit, right? Like, that's not just me supplanting everything I know about Adam Sandler and the way that he plays characters on this character.
It's gonna be really
sad
when we reveal to you that you're colorblind this whole time.
Yeah, right? No, that's actually wearing a bright red suit, Devin. Oh, no. Cool. So that's that. That is new, old, borrowed blue. I think we've said a lot of the things that have to be said about this movie.
Yeah.
Is there anything else that you feel needs to be touched on that you want to explore?
We did not dedicate nearly enough time, and it's because I could do a whole episode alone on the soundtrack of this film.
The synthesizer is beautiful. It's all Moog. It's beautiful.
The vaporwave soundtrack of this film is just amazing, and the ways in which it's used, both like it just to juxtapose what's happening on screen, to support what's happening on screen, it is beautifully put together. I am gonna butcher the guy's stage name, but hold on, I gotta practice this for a second before I say it. Onotrix? Onthrax? I don't know.
I think it's Onotrix.
Onotrix? Thank you. Onotrix Point Never is the full name of the artist, right? But he has an actual name that we should just use as we go forward. Daniel Lopatin, I believe. This is a huge project for him. As far as like albums that are available, he's got like one from like 2015 or something like that, and then like the soundtrack for Uncut Gems is like the other one. That being said, super prolific in like the EDM scene. So like it's not like the guy is not like well recognized for his work or like getting paid. But so just a phenomenal EDM artist, and then like coming in and doing this like synthy vaporwave soundtrack for this movie is something else. That combined with the fact that it was on film, which definitely, now that you say it, like hits, gives this movie that old movie feel, right? Like it feels like this could have been a movie from the 70s, or it could have been a movie from the 2070s. Like it makes this movie timeless. Like it's buck wild, and the soundtrack does a lot for that. Like the soundtrack is just awesome.
Yeah, I can't disagree. I don't disagree. It's beautiful. It's wonderful. Shout out to Indina Menzel, just because the Say Report, we're going to be talking about her, come the end of the year, little trailer for the other show that we do, seeing her in this movie, forgot that she played Howard's wife and she played she's not like, she's a presence, but she's, I don't even know how to describe it. She's so good in every scene that she is in. Major shout outs to when he is locked in the trunk, where she runs out in heels that she has no business running in. Like those are, I'm walking in these heels.
No, she's,
it is. It's wonderful.
Yeah. I mean, my biggest issue with Idina Menzel is not her in this movie, but her character is just so, it's so tropey in a lot of ways. It's another one that kind of hits as like a weird like note of, is this because this is a lesson to be learned? So like these characters kind of, you know, like Greek mythology and stuff, like these characters are not real people, they represent people, like that sort of bullshit. Or is it just another female character just not getting their due?
Well, I mean, because I think we're seeing it through Howard's eyes. And I think that's the big thing there, is that to him, she just exists to be his support system.
Yeah.
And she doesn't exist further than that.
And to the same point, Julia Fox in this movie as the girlfriend, as Julia, is again a force to be reckoned with. Like as a character, does some really great stuff, and there's phenomenal moments for her. But in the grand scheme of this movie, is just treated just like crap. And I hope at the end of this movie, she gets to run away with the high roller. Like
she gets to run away on her own.
Or that. Yes.
She just walked out of there with $1.2 million, and the guy that like it belongs to is dead.
Yeah, that's true. I just feel like the high roller is the kind of guy that she could definitely get to like do the dirty work for.
I don't disagree, but she's too smart to fall into that.
Sure.
Like, the fact that she's like, no, we can go now. No, don't get in the car. Get the fuck away from me, Wayne.
Yeah.
It is, like, the I actually really like that trope of her using him. Because he so deeply wants to use her. Like, it's so obvious the way that he talks to her and the way that he approaches her. And, like, even that guy that she's talking to in the sports book where he's like, what the fuck was up with that guy?
Yeah.
And the fact that, like, her and that guy are on the same level. And then that guy comes in trying to act like discount Mick Jagger and, like, everybody wants to fuck me because of who I am and how rich I am.
Yeah.
And her, like, not having any desire for it, but then seeing the value that he can provide to her by giving her a place to hide out is great. And that moment where he gets the money, my initial thought every time I've watched the film is that he fucking killed her and is stealing her money.
No, man.
Like, it is
The way in which she uses that guy at the end is But Julia Fox in this movie is...
And Julia Fox, this is her first role, too. She's just like a New York socialite. And they're like, hey, you know, you're pretty, like, well-known, and you know this stuff. You want to be in our movie? That's how you make a movie for $90 million, by the way. You get a bunch of non-union actors who you can pay in breadcrumbs.
And you don't write a script. You write it on the day of.
Yeah, that's a good point.
I'm not going to start giving the Safdie Brothers shit.
No. They clearly, this was their most scripted. It's not like Good Time where when Robert Pattinson's like, I'd like to be in a movie. They're like, yeah, okay.
let's
write a script for Robert Pattinson.
Yeah.
Will you play a vampire again?
No. Oh, okay.
Okay. That's fine. We had a pretty good vampire idea.
Okay. We're just spitballing here. Just give us a second.
All right. Here you go. This is 3 pages. This is your movie, Mr. Pattinson. I guess the last thing that I really want to address about this film before we pass judgment, as we so often do here at the ASCU, is how fucked up the timeline is. And, like, I don't want to do this. I don't want to be this person. But there are distinct moments in this movie where we are giving time references. For example, at Howard Ratner's colonoscopy, which everybody says this movie, the content of this movie, that's the one part of this movie that is like a bridge too far for me, watching that colonoscopy film. Like, I'm like, I gotta get past this because the rest of this movie's fantastic, but oh my god. We see on the screen that it is the 3rd of May, which then tracks with the Celtics and the series that they're playing against the Pistons and the fact that Kevin Garnett's birthday is the 19th of May. So their whole thing of like, he's going to be 36 this coming Saturday. All of that works. But what doesn't fucking work is a Seder in May when Passover in 2012 was April 9th to April 14th.
Well, you know, it's one of those late month seders that they do.
we like to do our seder a month later when the whole family is together and everything is less expensive because, you know, nobody's looking for it anymore. I don't know. Just the way like that's a moment where like that seder scene is hyper important. Like the plagues and Howard getting to be part of it, but Arno being an outsider in his family, it fuels so much of the narrative, so it's necessary, but it's so weird to have a Seder a month after Passover.
Yeah, I know. People do eighth night Seders, but they don't necessarily do 32nd night Seders.
It's like, I'm like, you know what? I'm just going to shut my brain off. But my initial thought was, oh, I didn't realize that Passover fell so late in 2012. And then I'm like, I need to check it. And I know that I can check it.
Yeah.
So if I'm completely off base on that, and it is something that does happen, let us know. Get in contact, because that is just one of those things where it doesn't make sense. Because Howard takes his thing on the 3rd, and then... It, by all accounts, it feels like it's the same day or maybe the next day.
Yeah.
When he gets the gem in.
Yeah.
So.
No, time is meaningless in this movie. And even within scenes, like, it almost feels like being in a casino. The idea that you're not really supposed to be thinking about what's going on outside of the room that you're in. So, like, they hide the clocks from you.
Yeah, plus all that oxygen they pipe into your house whenever you start watching this film.
Yeah. So, we forgot to mention when we were talking about Old, is that's actually Rob Schneider's colon on that movie. Yeah, I got nothing left, man.
That's a pretty good Old. That's a good borrowed, too. That's Shutterstock footage. I would have also said that they borrowed all the Celtics footage. But yeah, it's one of those things that I'm like, the second you start to think about the time in that movie, I'm like, none of this works. Like, yeah. None of this works. Because if he got the gem that early, he wouldn't have to rush it over to Adley's. For the auction that, by all accounts, is 3 weeks away.
Yeah.
And it sucks that it's May because I'm very aware of how May works with something like Brendan Fraser History Month. I have to know the dates and how time works in it. So it just, like, it unfortunately landed on me. And then I guess the one other thing besides that, and this is a happy one, I love that John Amos is... this movie. I love that John Amos is like the big celebrity cameo in this one, because that whole, like, you love this guy. He was in Good Times. He was Coming to America. Is he Coming to America? You're going to love this. Can my son use your bathroom? No.
Also, little like shout outs to like Tilda Swinton and Natasha Leone, and like a bunch of like small roles that go to like all of the off screen voices in this movie.
Tilda Swinton is so good as Anna Adley, but I love Natasha Leone every time when she's just like, "That's how you're gonna talk to me? What the hell is wrong with you?" Yeah, like, nobody takes crap from Howard unless they're face to face with Howard, and it's very interesting. All right. I've kind of been putting it off because I'm nervous. I'm nervous about this one. I'm nervous about passing judgment on Uncut Gems as to whether or not it's in the ASCU.
Okay.
And to put it in terms that are related to something like Uncut Gems, I have realized that whenever we're judging a film for inclusion in the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe, and again, the most important distinction is that this is Seijin and Mai's Cinematic Universe. It's not the ultimate definitive end-all be-all. This is the theory that we have developed, and we apply that theory to the films of Adam Sandler. So if you disagree, feel free. And I want to remind you that disagreements can happen, Seijin. because
hey man, yeah, why
every time we do this show we basically place a parlay bet, and that bet is against all of those like tenets that we have set out that make a film eligible to be charted in our maps of this Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. And the reason why you bring it up, Judd Hirsch, was so negative is that was the only bet that I felt I hadn't cleared. I had felt that I had cleared so many themes of films that made them eligible to be in our Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But the one that I couldn't do, and those themes like that magic is real and actually exists in this world. And in a lot of ways, it does feel like Howard is somehow charmed, and that Kevin Garnett draws some sort of mystical power from the Black Opal from Ethiopia that allows him to play those games to such extremes.
I mean, we also didn't talk about the fact that the Opal is basically the golden poop from American Dad. But
I would prefer the Maltese Falcon, the stuff dreams are made of.
I was gonna say
would have been a pretty good borrowed too, Devin.
No,
you fucking
but
idiot.
That would yeah, no, but that was the kind way to go about it. Does all of his luck start to turn once he gets the opal?
Kinda.
That actually is a really cool cool detail, is that it's once he touches the opal is when he starts to win all of his bets and all of that sort of stuff.
Yeah, and his bets are absurd.
Yeah,
15 to 1 odds on a 6-way parlay.
I don't think to watch this movie if that is true. I will give you that perhaps magic is real in this movie. Let's keep going.
Okay, so perhaps magic is real. There are heavy themes of family and the family that you surround yourself with and that support. And one of Howard's greatest flaws is not seeing that support system, not seeing that family that is so clearly willing to go to any ends to help him out of this situation. I mean, the fact that Gooey is like willing to bid up the gem at the auction, that's huge. that's just a huge moment. So that you have family, right? Family is a big thing. Women who do not need to be saved by Adam Sandler. That's a pretty big part too, Seijin. That's a pretty big important thing that occurs in these movies.
I don't know, man. The way the women are treated in this movie are not the powerful women that we've pointed to in past films.
They're not the same level of powerful of those other women, but none of them need Howard Ratner. Howard Dina, Ratner needs him.
I will give you that Dinah does not, or Dina? Dinah?
Dina.
D-I-N-A-A. That she definitely does not. So there is at least a representation of that in this movie. Yeah, I don't know. The stuff with Julia is so hard because, like, she doesn't need him, but she definitely comes out ahead because of him by the end of this movie. You know what I mean? Like, the place that she is in at the end of this movie is a little bit of a better one than she's in the beginning of this movie.
We say that, but we don't know what her reaction to Howard being dead is going to be. She is leaving the Mohegan Sun expecting to get to ride off into the sunset with Howard.
Yeah, and she's not going to get that.
We don't, like, she is, that moment, she is so happy. But the thought is not, this is my money. The thought is, this is our money. This is our future.
I think the spirit of the law is an important conversation to have here about this particular rule right now, because I think what it is that it's always the idea that they could give or take him, but their lives are made better by having him in it. So they accept him into it and they allow him into it because of that. Right. So they see him as adding to their already bountiful life. Right.
Yeah.
And that is what's key is, and that is what's really powerful about the women in Adam Sandler movies is that it is that the fact that they don't need him to be happy, but they want him in order to be happy is the thing. And they choose him, which is different than some of these other dopier comedies where we see the guy and the woman and it feels like it's a chore for her to be with him. And we definitely see that in some Adam Sandler movies, which is why they don't hit that rule. Right.
Right.
In this movie, he is a chore to them. There's no ifs, ands, or buts about it. He taking him on is a choice that they are making that makes their lives actively worse.
All right, that's fair. That's a fair argument, but it was one of those things where I'm like, it's definitely hitting that spot right there. I gotta go back to some of the other ones that we have.
No, bring them up.
But the big one, the one that I was having trouble reconciling, that I was having trouble coming to terms with, is that there's no one else from the other movies, right? We don't have Alan Covert as the guy on the sports radio, which would have been a cool connective tissue thing. We don't have Jonathan Loughran as, like, a security guard in some moment. Peter Dante isn't, like, getting restrained at the Diamond Exchange. We don't have any of those things. I mean, Rob Schneider, aside from his colon, we don't have him in this movie. And it's one of those situations that, like, those have become such hallmarks to being in the Adam Sandler cinematic universe for me. And what I kept saying to myself is, it's not in there. It's not in there. As much as, like, it feels like it could be, and on some level it should be in our cinematic universe based on the laws that we have set out, because there isn't one person that he has worked with before that is sort of scratching that nostalgia bean for me. I don't think I can put it in the universe, but then you bring up that he's worked with Judd Hirsch before and you really threw my whole world into disarray. I feel like Howard Ratner at this moment.
So again, it's about examining the spirit of the law, right? When we talk about him bringing in people to work with him and that idea, it's that he creates an environment where people want to be around him and he wants certain people around him so that they can work and have fun and do this thing together. And it's not that I don't think that they didn't. It's not. I think he enjoyed working with the Savvy Brothers to the fucking point where we now know that they are working on another project together at this point in time, right? And so it's not that wasn't true. I don't know if this was necessarily a fun movie to work on with some of the intensity that's going on. And to that, Judd Hirsch and the scenes that he's in this movie and the scenes that he's in with him in the limited scenes he's in with him in the Meyerowitz stories, like, it doesn't scream the same to me as, like, he goes out and gets a beer with Judd Hirsch and goes, hey, you want to be in this movie with me? That's not what happens. Right? Yep, like, that's just not what it feels like is what happens in this movie. Whereas, you know, Grown Ups, when he literally just calls all of his friends and he's just like, You guys want to go to a water park for this one? Like, you know what I mean? Like that's just not the, it's not the same spirit of the thing when you're talking about Judd Hirsch showing up in this movie. So like, take a rest on that one. It's not the same thing.
Okay. All right. Cause I mean, that was it. Like, honestly, that's where I'm at. That's my big problem with this. If there's one person and then you're being like, Judd Hirsch, they were in that movie together. And I'm like, oh fuck. Oh,
I was
fuck.
Grasping at the thinnest of paper straws when I pulled Judd Hirsch out of my ass on that one.
Well, that's not surprising because I felt the same way. Yeah. So that's pretty good. So, I mean, I guess if you are willing to say that, and again, we haven't watched Meyerowitz stories, and much like the code of conduct in School Ties, our Adam Sandler cinematic universe is a living organism and up for change at any time. So when we see Meyerowitz stories, if I see that like spark of, oh no, Adam Sandler enjoyed these moments. And when he's like, guys, I could maybe get Judd Hirsch to read for this.
Yeah.
And I think you're going to have fun. It seems like the type of role, because you talk about like, guys, let's go to a water park, right? Which I assume is Grown Ups. I've never seen it.
But yes.
What?
Grown Ups too, but yes.
I think of Go The on. Way, Way Back. That's the only nice. Water park movie I think of. Is one of those situations where that's a certain type of fun for the Grown Ups crew. But being in a film like this, I think is the type of film that Judd Hirsch would be looking for.
Sure. Yeah. No, I can appreciate that. And it's not even that they don't have some relationship. Maybe they do. It's not one that I'm aware of. But it really does come down to that idea of they could give or take the movie. It's about hanging out together. And the movie is just kind of a coincidental thing that happens is kind of the feeling you get a lot of the times when Sandler and his friends are together. And that feels good because it feels like you're being invited almost into like home movies sometimes when those guys are on screen together. That is not – everybody in this movie is here to work.
Yeah, that's true. If Dan Patrick had been the bookie instead of Mike Francesca, it would have worked. So – okay, yeah. So I guess at that point, I don't complete the parlay. And much as I like this movie, I love this movie. I fucking love this movie. And it's so weird to say that as this movie that like, I've kind of had this weird tenuous relationship because of this show. But as much as I do love this film, and as much as I still consider it a villain amongst the Adam Sandler films, I guess it's not in our universe. It doesn't have a place in our Adam Sandler cinematic universe. That being said, I am fully convinced that our Adam Sandler cinematic universe exists within that black opal from this movie.
Well, considering the like weird Ant-Man style like opening scene where we're like going through the multiverse of that opal that comes out in New York.
Well, they say that you could see the whole universe in an opal. And maybe that whole universe is the Adam Sandler cinematic universe. And maybe one of the reasons why Howard gets to experience some of the magic that we categorize as such a big part of our Adam Sandler cinematic universe is because he is holding that in his hand. He is getting that little touch of the Adam fun. And that's why he's suddenly winning bets. And that's why everything is turning around for him until ultimately it's not. And that's the other thing I want to talk about. The moment where Phil decides, I don't care how this turns out, I'm killing this motherfucker. And it is when Howard says, oh, Phil, is that one of you guys? That big fat fuck? You know him? And you see it in Keith William Richards' eyes that, like, I'm killing him. I don't give a fuck what happens. He's dead.
Yeah. It's pretty much he seals his own fate in that moment. Yeah.
And to think of all the things that he has done in the movie up to that point, for that to be the thing, the least, like the most innocuous thing he does being the thing that has him wind up dead is really something. Plus, we start in his colon and we end at his cheek. So we go through his whole body.
The only other question that I think I have, and I want to leave this with everybody because I don't know if there's an answer or not. Maybe there's not. Maybe there is a solid one. But that moment that is the picture of him on the cover of this movie, is this after he's dead? Because he's holding his cheek.
Yeah.
Just curious.
I mean, it's meant to be. It is meant to be.
It feels like it's meant to be.
It is foreshadowing for the fact that he dies.
Yeah.
And that is where he's shot and he is nursing his wound.
Yeah.
So you are like, you're walking into really just like fucked up. And it supports the fact that it's probably not in the ASCU, which you haven't given a definitive answer yet. I mean, you gave a definitive answer in November 2020, but I want to hear it in this episode, Seijin. I don't.
I should have placed a bet then that I had, it was such a called shot. But even then it looked like it was an easy one because yeah. No, this is not in, right? Like yeah. it just isn't. And I knew it in my gut at the time, and on rewatching with literal years behind us now to actually like lay down the law, I can confidently say it isn't. Yeah.
Right. And it's okay that it's not.
Oh yeah.
Right. It doesn't have the sensibilities. It doesn't have the creative spirit of it. So it all makes sense in that. Yeah. And so really what this film is we are seeing Howard's life flash before his eyes in that last moment before his death. That's what this film is. And I think that the moments that he are seeing, the moments that he is remembering are more those moments that were strife for him. Because, yeah. Like, so truly for this character.
Suffering yeah. is life. I mean, it's
exactly. Because we are led to believe it's been kind of a gilded path for him until he discovers sports gambling where, like, I'm not good at this. I'm bad at this. And I can be worse at it. And I feel alive finally because of that.
Yeah.
It's his jumping in front of trains, right? That Ariel does in Footloose. It is his way to feel alive. And it's unfortunate that just as he starts to get good at it is when he ultimately expires. Interesting stuff. All right. So do we want to wrap up the villain stuff here so that Hustle is completely unfettered? Do you want to, like, examine the themes of what we did here?
Or? I mean, you know, it was hard to truly go completely villainous with Sandler, right?
Yes.
Because he just has not, he's not really done that. Even in this movie, he's never truly gone to the totally unlikable, unlovable character. These movies all just kind of exemplify that. Like this is the worst he's got, right? Like, you know, it's not to say that we're not going to come up against other movies that we feel just kind of rub us the wrong way and things like that too. So don't think that it's all going to be sunshine and roses from here on out. But it's just that these are the ones that stand out as having some type of detrimental effect, either on like our understanding of him as an actor, our understanding of his career, or, you know, like the world's kind of like turning its nose up at him. Like there was something that happened with each of these films that really kind of took things in a different direction for him. and in that they became very antagonistic throughout his career. Even this one, as good as it was, it now puts him in this weird position where it's much like when Punch Drunk Love came out at the time, people are just going to spend all of their time now talking about like, man, it's a shame he did this one because he could really act in Uncut Gems. It's kind of setting a bar up that people are going to expect him to jump every time, and that's just not how it works.
Yeah, it's a strange thing the way that works, because Hubie Halloween, which is his next film after this, it's his follow-up, was sort of universally beloved.
Yeah.
But still there were those people who are like, but it's not the same Adam Sandler that we saw in Uncut Gems. But I think if we've proven anything, not just in this season of villains, but in everything that we've looked at up to this point in these first three seasons of the Adam Sandler cinematic universe, there is the fact that Adam Sandler is two different actors. He's two different archetypes. And sometimes you're going to get the serious, like, dramatic Adam, and sometimes you're going to get the one who wants to have a good time and hang out with his friends and just do a fun, funny movie that speaks to his sensibilities. And perhaps the greatest trick that the Sandler ever played was being able to maintain a balance between the two. I don't know.
Fantastic.
All right. So this has been the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe. But don't go anywhere, or I don't know how to talk about this. We dropped another episode, right? You just got to listen to this episode about Uncut Gems. And there's another one. Episode 20 is out there. It is on Hustle. It's so hard to not call it the Hustle. I love noun movies. now in movie titles that don't put the in front of it. So look forward to that. And again, we haven't seen it at the time, but Seijin is, you're putting a bet on you enjoy it, but you think he's going to be dead by the end?
No, I don't think he's going to be dead by the end. But I am looking forward to it. You know, we watched, what was the Kevin James one there that came out of Homelander
Home
or whatever it was? Home Team, thanks.
Homelander, yeah, because Kevin James is in The Boys now.
Yeah, we watched Home Team and we're not impressed. So there's definitely reason to be concerned, I guess is the right way of putting it. Not really.
I mean, it's not like Adam was in Home Team. I mean, well, there's going to be an episode eventually where we talk about things like Home Team. But
in terms of like the Netflix stuff has not always been 100%. Let's use Adam Sandler terms here. Ridiculous six, right? Like we have seen the Netflix movies maybe not do what we want them to do as fans, right?
And so I loved Ridiculous Six. I'm just going to remind the world that, but
yes. But then the world will remind you that it did not.
And feel free.
And so this might be, you know, so we don't know what we're getting into. There's no guarantees here. This is not a but this is our first chance to really do one live, and we're going to do it live.
Yeah. And as live as a recorded medium can be,
live as podcasting allows.
Yes, in real time. That's sort of what it is. We're reviewing it in real time and seeing if this whole theory that we've put together works in real time, or if it does need that time to sit and marinate on the vine before it ripens to a point where we can determine its inclusion in our ASCU. All right. But in case you don't listen to that episode, and I don't know why you wouldn't listen to that episode, I do just want to let everybody know that season 4 is going to be coming in July. We're just going to keep the gas pedal to the floor. And season 4 is for the fans. And that's for you guys. That's for you people out there, the ones who listen to this show, the ones who interact with us regarding it. So we're going to try to handle some of the movies that people have asked us, well, where did this one fall? How do you guys feel about this movie? So the first one we're doing, Siege, and I think you'll agree with me on this one, is probably the most requested film that comes up. And that's going to be, I was going to do a joke here, but I'm not going to. Big Daddy. Big Daddy is what you're going to want to watch in order to prepare for our July episode.
Yeah, I mean, one of my most requested films, second maybe only to Mr. Deeds.
Yes, and it's not just Siegen, though. A lot of people, whenever I tell them I have the Adam Sandler podcast, the thing is like, well, what'd you guys think about Big Daddy? And I'm like, well, like the first time I saw it, because we haven't done it on the show yet. Oh, why the fuck haven't you done Big Daddy yet? Well, the more you ask, the more I'm going to put it off.
Take that, fans.
Mostly because For the Fans is something that I've had in my mind for a while. So it is Big Daddy. We have heard you and we are answering. But also, if there is a film that you think we should do, let us know, right?
Yes.
Generally, we have the season sort of set in stone, but season 4, we are turning it over to you, right? You've heard us talk about 19 films at this one, 20 after Hustle. So there's got to be movies that you guys want to hear about, and we would love to make sure that we get to them and make it sort of an open dialogue with you, the listener. So we are looking forward to that. So Whitey will tell you at the end, but it is at the ASCU on Twitter if you want to send that to us. Or you can always send us an email to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe @gmail.com. If you enjoyed us applying all of our pop culture knowledge to the films of Adam Sandler, you'd probably enjoy us applying it to literally everything else that exists in the world. And that's what the Say Report is for. Episodes of that are available every Monday. And that is available wherever you find podcasts, wherever they can be found. And if you would like to yell at Seijin, let's say about the spelling of his name. He can be found on Twitter @ Siege versus the World.
And if you have a bet you want to place on the 2012 Celtics, you can find Devin @ Devin D. Decker.
I'm taking all bets, people, and I'm giving good odds, better odds than your local book. I'm the one you want to call. All right. So without any further ado, thank you very much for listening to this episode. And just remember, as we pass you off to our closing message, we have no idea what we're doing. Have a good night, folks. Thank you so much for listening to the Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe Podcast. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe so it's delivered straight to you. And why not write or review? If you want to get in touch with us on Twitter, we're at the ASCU. And you can always send an electronic mail to Adam Sandler Cinematic Universe @gmail.com. Thank you so much for listening. Apologize to your mother for me, and we'll see you next time.
I'm just going to say this. Uncut Gems isn't part of the universe. Fight me on that.